You are on the record.
Thank you.
This is
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the October 23rd ADA board meeting. And I would like to call the meeting to order. And I'd ask Quinn to roll call the board members, please.
Ms. Sandy.
Here.
Deputy Commissioner Samaroski.
Present.
Mr. Ketting.
Here.
Mr. Fogel.
Here.
Mr. Anderson.
Here.
Mr. Carl.
Here.
Mr. Bruce.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. Quinn, would you continue with staff and public, please?
Okay, as I point to you, please state your name and organization. There's a lot of room. I'll start this way.
From the AEA.
First there, AEA.
Back wall.
Oh, Sunny Morrison, next way.
Brenda Applegate, ADA.
Alan Weissner, ADA.
Ted Leonard, Matt Sue Burrow. John Lucy Mendes, who's in the borough.
Una Ellsworth, ADA.
Jeff Van Wong, ADA.
Ben Britton, Interior Gas Utility.
Ben Bryant, ADA, AEA. Glenn, ADA.
Steve Hagginson, Interior Gas Utility.
Tom Florio, HGR Engineer.
Amy Subbuck, ADA.
Lex Sorrento, ADA.
Shirley Severson, ADA.
Sheriff Beckrow.
Jeffrey
Johns, ADA.
Mm-hmm.
Ada.
Neola Hakala,
ADA.
Chris
Anderson, ADA.
Mark Davis, ADA.
Sam Tappan,
ADA.
Karsten Rodvik, ADA. Kobe Lawrence, Sewer Wildlife Cruises. Tom Tugas, Sewer Wildlife Cruises at Harbor 360 Hotel.
Gary Tude, Department of Law.
Frank Kempenick, ADA. Do we have public on the phone?
Hi,
good morning. Okay, the gentleman who spoke first. Oh, sorry, it was on mute.
Morning.
Hey, you got to take us off mute.
Whoever's got us on mute or on hold, please take us off.
Good morning, this is Tim Redder from First National Bank.
Hold on.
Everybody on the phone, please disconnect and recall back in because somebody has us on hold with their music.
Okay.
And we will be reconnected in a few minutes. But there's always the chance that we'll still be their music because it doesn't... It doesn't close altogether. We'll see if we can get something.
So Julie's going to have to call back in?
Yes. Hopefully everybody will disconnect and call back in, but I don't know about that hold person.
Well, Corinne, you can also call her operator and tell. She'll know who it is.
Oh.
And disconnect.
Yeah. What now? What was that?
Call the operator.
Call the operator, and the operator knows.
Disconnect the one that has the music on the mute.
We have that in other meetings.
Welcome to Open Voice Audio Services. Please enter your conference room number followed by the pound or hash sign. Conference room number accepted. If you are the organizer, press the star key now. Please enter your PIN followed. For a menu of available commands, press star 1.
Open voice. Sherry's trying to try to figure out. Has public been able to log back in?
Good morning, yes. This is Gary. Good morning, this is Gary Wilkin, Interior Gas Utility Board of Directors.
Good morning, Mr. Wilkin.
Hi, this is...
Good morning, Corinne.
Hi, this is Cindy Cartledge with Jermaine Dunnigan and Owen.
Cindy who?
Cartledge.
Cartledge?
From where?
This is Mike Keller.
Cindy, who are you
Mike
from?
Mike Keller calling from Interior Energy Project, board member.
What was your name, sir?
Mike Miller.
Mike Miller.
Yes, thank you.
Any other public on the phone?
Good morning. This is Alan Tim Redder from First National Bank in Kenai.
Okay. Any other public on the phone?
Alan Bailey for Paw Petroleum News.
Alan who from?
Alan Bailey, Petroleum News.
Paw Petroleum News.
Okay, Alan Bailey. Okay, I want to make sure.
So I just have to keep it on. Hold the line.
Any other public?
Good morning. It's James Brooks from the Anchorage Daily News.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Any other public?
Do not put us on hold.
Please do not put us on hold. You can mute us, but don't put us on hold. Thank you.
Thanks, Corinne. For the board members, item number four is agenda approval. Tom, any deletions or corrections or anything that you want to propose to change?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. On new business, I propose that 7D, 7 Delta, the Navison upgrade be moved to the end, please.
After executive session?
Yes, please.
Okay. Is there any objection to that?
No objection.
All right. Seeing no objections, we'll move item C, or correction, item D to the end. All right, any further? All right, do I have a motion for the approval of the agenda?
I make a motion we approve the agenda as amended.
Second it.
Seeing no objection, the agenda is approved. That brings us to public comments. So I'll remind everybody, please limit public comments to 3 minutes. Please state your name and affiliation, if you have one, affiliation on the record so that we have that. And I will start online first. Is anybody online wishing to make a public comment? Anybody online? Hearing nobody online, anybody in the boardroom? Nobody in the boardroom? All right, I'll close public comments. That brings us up to item number six, prior minutes for September 18, 2019. Assume board members have had a chance to review and look at the prior minutes. I will take a motion to put it on the table.
So moved. Second.
Discussion? Objection? Seeing no objection, the minutes are approved. Brings us to item number seven, new business. First up this morning is our friends from Fairbanks, Interior Gas Utility, your energy project. Tom?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We have here to make a presentation Dan Britton, CEO of IGU, Interior Gas Utility, and Steve Haggerson, Chairman of the Board. And so I'll just ask them to come up, and I'll sit over here while they make their presentation.
Great. Welcome, Dan and Steve. Appreciate you coming down to visit with us.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank your other board members on the line listening in, and especially former ADA board member, AA board member Gary Wilkin. I don't know what part of the country he's in. Probably someplace warm.
Thank you. It's nice to join you.
I think he's on his second Mai Tai by now.
Yeah, probably. So, welcome, and look forward to your presentation on the update for the IGU.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the rest of the board members. It's great to be here today to provide an update on the Interior Energy Project and the Interior Gas Utility. We've got some exciting things happen, so it's really my pleasure to be here. As introduced, I've got with me our chair, Steve Haggerson, today. And on the phone, as you recognize, we've got Director Wilkin, Director Miller. I'm not sure if others have joined since the roll call was taken, but thank all of them for joining us today. Just as a reminder, why we're here, what the project's all about, is the Interior Energy Project's purpose and the goals as to bring low-cost energy to as many residents and businesses of interior Alaska as possible, as quickly as possible. We're trying to stabilize the economy and help improve air quality. I'll give you a little bit of history on the project. In the background of natural gas in Fairbanks before we got into the update of where we're at today. But in 1998, Fairbanks Natural Gas began operating in Fairbanks for the first time, giving interior Alaska residents the opportunity to heat their homes or businesses with natural gas. So that was the first time natural gas has been available in Fairbanks. Since that time, from 1998 up until 2015, it was a privately held utility. So it's important to recognize that there's been an operating utility in Fairbanks that's been operating, making money, operating effectively and efficiently, and expanding service over time, which has got us to where we're at today and expanding to additional customers. So we do have an operating utility. That's one thing that's sometimes forgotten as we move forward with some of these new larger projects, that we do have a base load that we're working from today. In 2012, the Fairbanks North Star Borough acquired its natural gas utility power via transfer from the city of Fairbanks and the city of North Pole, and established at that time the Interior Natural Gas Utility. And that's today who we are. We have one utility in Fairbanks today, the Interior Gas Utility, and that's who we're speaking on behalf of. In 2013, SB 23 was signed into law, establishing the Interior Energy Project, providing ADA with a financing package to finance and develop the supply and delivery of additional natural gas supplies to the Interior Alaska and expand the service capabilities. In 2015, as a result of some changes in the project plan and project scope, the project was taken back to the legislature for authorization to move away from liquefaction on the North Slope and back to the Cook Inlet as an option. At that time, HB 105 was signed into law, enacted to renew and advance the Interior Energy Project. At that time, it required the ADA Board of Directors to approve by resolution a project plan prior to any further funding that was established by it, SB 23 being expended. In 2015, ADA purchased Pentex Alaska Natural Gas Company. That was the company that owned Fairbanks Natural Gas, the Titan Alaska Liquefaction Facility. That's the liquefaction facility in Point McKenzie. You like me to pause, or?
I do not know.
Well, all you need to do is turn it down, Corinne, because the public can't make it down. There it goes.
It goes lower. If we're going lower, nobody's going to hear us on the phone.
That's just...
Dana, I can just text you if I have any comments or questions.
Okay.
Okay. Well, it's gotten quiet.
All right. See what happens.
I can hear you fine.
All right.
So in 2015, ADA purchased Pentex, which was the privately held portion of the utilities that were providing service in Fairbanks. And they did so to further the advancement of the Interior Energy Project and to assist in the creation of a single utility in Fairbanks. In 2018, the Interior Gas Utility purchased the Pentex assets from ADA, at that time creating a single gas utility in Fairbanks. And as part of that, we established the finance agreement that would govern the future financing of the remaining portions of the Interior Energy Project. In addition, ADA did pass, the ADA Board of Directors did pass an HB 105 plan, which allowed for the monies set aside for the Interior Energy Project to be expended and the project to begin being advanced. I'm happy to take questions as I go, Mr. Chair, or just at the end, whatever you prefer. I'll continue if there isn't any.
I think if there's any questions as you go, I welcome the board members to interact with you.
Great. So the project scope first is liquefaction. providing gas service to Fairbank is unique from many other gas utilities in that we do not have pipeline gas available to us in Fairbanks. So we have to find an alternative means to transport that gas to make it available to customers. And how we do that is with a liquefaction facility that's been located in Point McKenzie since 1998. And it has been in operation, continuous operation since that time. And that's called the Titan One facility. That facility produces about 50,000 gallons a day of liquefied natural gas today. So we buy our gas. Today it's through a contract with Hilcorp. We transport that gas on the Hilcorp or Harvest pipeline system and NSTAR pipeline system, where we take delivery of the gas at the plant gate of the Titan liquefaction facility. At that point, we'll liquefy the gas to minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit. When you liquefy natural gas, one volume of LNG or liquid natural gas, when expanded, is 600 times in its gaseous form. So we're liquefying it so that we can efficiently transport and store enough volume to be able to serve the customers we're trying to serve in Fairbanks. Our next step is the transportation. So once it's liquefied, we need to move it from the Point McKenzie facility to our locations in Fairbanks. Today we're doing that utilizing specialized LNG trailers. In our fleet today we have 17 trailers, and we'll continue to expand that as demand dictates. Just a side note, it isn't anywhere else, I don't think, in my presentation, but we did participate with Alaska Railroad on a pilot project. The Alaska Railroad's the first railroad to receive approval to transport LNG in ISO containers. And we did that a number of years ago, successfully transported about 8 loads without any issues or concern. So in the future, we'll continue to look at the railroad as a viable option, a potentially viable option for as we expand our service for transporting the LNG.
Did that make economic sense when you did that?
It does in certain circumstances. Right now, and we'll get in some more detail, but our LNG inventory in Fairbanks is about 340,000 gallons. We're a just-in-time inventory situation. So as soon as we have room in one of our tanks, we receive a delivery, especially in the wintertime, because we want to maximize our inventory for security of supply. In order to do so, we send a truck, we get it back in 20 hours. Railroad's more conducive to a batch type of operation where we'll send a larger quantity, receive it, offload it all, and then send back the empties. So once we increase our demand and supply, we'll start to see the economies make sense. We don't have an LNG, or excuse me, a rail spur at our liquefaction facility, so we have to handle the product multiple times, which takes away what you would assume to be the general efficiencies of the rail, so that it adds costs that take away some of the attractiveness. But as we move forward and expand, the more volumes start to make sense to have some of those additional investments.
So Dan, thinking back to many questions that a former board member had on your LNG trailers, where's the pups?
So, pups. we have not ordered pups yet, but three of our newest trailers, our larger capacity trailers, were designed to allow us to haul a pup or an additional trailer behind the base unit. The idea there is that you can increase your efficiencies and lower your costs in transportation. Given a lot of some of the other things we've been focused on, I have not focused on that yet. It does create, a different risk profile that has to be fully evaluated before we decide to move in that direction. So we haven't pulled that trigger yet, but it's still in the back of our minds.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
We have two new litters of pups, so I could donate a pup and they could have it in a cab.
Yeah. So once the LNG is transported to Fairbanks, we have to have a place to store it. And we are working actively on two storage facility upgrades in Fairbanks. The first is a 5.25 million gallon project that I'll talk a little bit more. And the second is a new storage facility for the first time in North Pole that would allow us to begin serving customers in a previously installed distribution system in North Pole. And once that facility is constructed, that's the first time natural gas service will be available in North Pole. From there, we have what's now a conventional gas utility, which is the buried distribution pipes. We have now 140. In 2014 and 15, as part of the Interior Energy Project, approximately 140 miles of new pipeline were constructed. about 70 miles in Fairbanks and 70 miles in North Pole. The pipes constructed in Fairbanks are gasified now. The pipes in North Pole are under nitrogen pressure and awaiting the LNG facility to be installed before we can gasify and begin serving customers off of those systems. So much, a lot of the distribution expansion, or the first phase of the distribution expansion that's part of this project, is installed and waiting for additional supplies and new customers.
Do you have to de-liquefy the gas before you put it in the Fairbanks pipelines? Is there a plant for there? How does that all work?
Yes, we do. So what's this? Somebody trying to talk in the background, maybe? I don't know.
Please mute your end of the phone. It's distracting here at our end. Thank you.
Yeah, great question. So the liquefied gas, we do have to warm it and turn it back to gas before it enters our distribution, buried distribution pipeline. And so we have two forms of gas that's entering the pipeline. One is the LNG at minus 260 degrees. When it's stored, naturally starts to boil off. And as it's boiling off, you have to handle that gas, or otherwise it'll build excessive pressure in your storage tanks. And we take that boil-off gas and we send it out into the distribution system.
And are you making power at that letdown, or are you using any kind of an expander and making electricity when you're letting the gas down?
We are not.
Have you thought about that?
We've looked at it. The amount of volume that we have hasn't been enough to support much power production. We haven't focused on that significantly, so I couldn't say I've spent a great deal of time exploring it. We are using the boil-off gas out of our storage project to keep our ground frozen. I'll talk about that in a little bit.
So your answer was, as the gas boils off, it's used in the pipeline. You don't have a plant per se to degasify, to deliquefy.
We have both. So the boil-off gas, it doesn't boil off in a quantity sufficient to meet our demand, but we don't want to vent the boil-off gas. So we first consume the boil-off gas in the distribution system. Anything additionally needed by our customer demand is vaporized through a heated vaporizer. So the LNG goes through a heat exchanger that's cross-exchanged with warm glycol, and it goes from the minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit to somewhere between 60 and 100 degrees before it enters the distribution pipe. So that's part of our storage facilities. So we actually refer to them as storage and vaporization facilities. The distribution build-out in North Pole was for the first phase of three phases that are planned in that area. The first phase that was constructed in 2015 was the first phase. And as we'll talk about a little bit further, we've got services and meters that are then required. So we've got the main lines in the street. In order to take gas to people's homes and businesses, we run a small service line to a meter at the building. And from that point, it's metered, and the gas goes into whatever appliances they're utilizing in their system. And the last part of the project is a customer conversion program. In order to get new customers, the customer has to convert from an alternative fuel unless it's a new construction. So we'll be looking at programs to incentivize, make easy the conversion process to ensure we get a high level of conversion and demand on our system.
Dan, do you have any of the local government entities jumping in supporting the conversion? Are they tied with you on that? Are they offering any type of incentives themselves, the borough, the cities?
So we've been working with the borough. The borough has a program that's supported from the federal government Clean Air Shed Grants. They have a wood stove exchange program. And the conversion of a wood stove to natural gas has the highest priority on that program, as it provides the most reduction in air emissions that they can achieve. So customers can qualify for that. And I don't know if you noticed in the paper, but the borough did just receive an additional $5 million for 2020 for that program. And so those monies can be used for conversion. Additionally, the current administration in the borough is looking at some other options for helping out. We don't have those fully defined yet, but they're engaged with us and recognize the importance gas plays in the air quality issue and in the success of the Interior Energy Project. So we're coordinating and working with them.
So when you do your financial analysis, you know, conversion obviously is a pretty big component of that. If you build it, will they come? What matrix do you use for the conversions that you anticipate to build your business case off of?
So the IGU 20-year capital plan and pro forma, which is what we work from and continue to update, utilizes a study that was done by ADA called the Cardno study, Cardno Entrex. And that study looked at people's likelihood of conversion at various oil prices versus gas prices and predicted what the conversion numbers might be for that. And we use, we call it a 35% Cardno number as our base case. And what that says is that the customers that we have access to with our expansion, within a 10-year time frame, 35% of those customers will convert to natural gas. And that's under our base case. We do have a higher case conversion analysis that if our gas costs, our raw gas cost into the liquefaction plant is reduced, we would see a higher conversion rate because we'd have a higher savings rate between oil and gas. And that would be a 50% conversion, which improves the economics even more. And so those are the two cases we look at as we plan for this system expansion. Some of the things that might drive additional conversion are the clean air issues in Fairbanks. There may become a time when there's additional regulation with regards to what products are burned, and which could drive continued pressure on the economics. So some of those things all have a beneficial impact on conversions in the future.
So has the city of Fairbanks or the city of North Pole started the process or considered changing their code to new construction or replacement of the existing boilers to be dual fired?
There is no contemplated code changes that I'm aware of right now with regards to new construction.
Would that help your organization if that was the case? I mean, if you're going to put builds, I mean, it doesn't cost a lot more money. I mean, it's $100 or $200.
Yeah.
I don't know what it costs per furnace, but to be able to go from oil to natural gas on new furnaces,
anything that drives efficiency of conversion for our business in the future would be helpful for the project. That's for sure.
So there's been no request by your organization yet to Fairbanks or North. I don't think the borough can do it. They don't have that power, but the cities do, don't they? Under their codes.
The cities could put in codes that require certain appliances and those types of things. So they could. We have not put in a request for that right now. As I'm sure many of you have read and are aware, the air quality issues in Fairbanks are a pretty highly political sensitive issue. The borough residents voted to have the state be responsible for the air quality issue versus the local government. So it is fairly contentious issue that we haven't waded into yet.
Steve, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm not sure about the dual fuel for residential. I know that commercial has dual fuel capabilities, but residentials don't, that I know of. So I think you're going to see more of them put in a direct conversions for most residential applications. And we're trying to get both. And I think the borough has a program. We're trying to encourage that using some clean air money. There's a lot of people trying to figure out how to get conversion costs down and how to make it more efficient. There's some issues with quantity of contractors, people, and we'll probably import them from Anchorage if we need them. But there's a lot of hurdles there to getting conversions, but I think we're doing everything we can to increase our sales, make sure the conversions go as easy as possible.
So they don't make a furnace for a home that's dual fired that you could convert for fairly easy on the market right now?
So it's not dual fired. What you do is you have to replace the oil burner with a gas burner. So you remove the oil burner and you have a gas burner. So the boiler itself gets certified in advance to either have a gas burner or an oil burner. And it's
you just have to change the gun out
You
then.
Change the gun and yeah. install the piping. And that's a much less costly conversion, but it's in the $1,500 to $2,500 range. Okay. Yeah.
What about all this new construction on Eielson for the new soldiers coming?
Yeah.
Are the natural gas piping being put onto the base?
So the most of the new construction for Eielson, for new housing, they're looking a lot of it to be off-base. The construction that's happening is actually infrastructure to support the F-35's, hangars, maintenance facilities, those types of construction activities that are taking place. The Eielson Air Force Base itself right now is gets its heat and power from a combined coal-fired facility, and so it serves its own heat and power today. Those facilities are quite old, and the military bases and are likely to look at conversions in the future. The Fort Wainwright actually is in just started an EIS process for their combined heat and power plant. It's a 60-year-old coal-fired facility also. And the four options that they have identified in their EIS is one, do nothing, which is probably not a likely solution. The other is to replace the existing coal-fired combined heat and power with new coal-fired. And then the other two options are gas-related, that replace the combined heat and power with a natural gas-fired combined heat and power facility, or do distributed heat and electricity. So they would put new boilers in the buildings to serve individual structures or groupings of buildings, and utilize power produced from Golden Valley to their facilities. So those are the four options they're looking. That's likely a 5 to 10 year time horizon before we know which direction they'll go. But conversion to natural gas by the basis would certainly help our demand. Also would improve the air quality issues in our borough as well. So I think they're, you know, for the first time in a long time, we've been able to sit down with the military and say, yes, we have a plan to serve you. We can provide service. We can, depending on your requirements, meet your security of supply and your mission critical needs. They've identified that as about 14 days of supply for their mission critical facility. So you'll see through construction of our new storage facility, the plans we have for liquefaction expansion, that starts to create the confidence in our project and the delivery system that others can start to rely on for their future long-term planning.
If I can add on to that, back on your bed down or the F-35, a lot of contractors some contractors are putting in propane systems that will easily convert to natural gas. So as soon as it's available, they can switch right over.
Thank you.
Good point. Thank you, Steve. Yeah, and customers that are building new know that we're actively working on our projects are doing that, putting propane in, and then as soon as we have the availability of supply, we can hang a meter and they can make that switch very quickly. So with that, I'll give you a little project status of where we're at with the different phases, and I'll start at the front, which is liquefaction. As I said, today we operate a facility that produces 50,000 gallons of LNG today. We kicked off a feed study, front-end engineering and design, to expand that facility by an additional 100,000 gallons per day.
And Dan, just to clarify for new board members, the liquefaction facility is at Point McKenzie?
It's at Point McKenzie,
okay.
Yeah.
Have you chosen that's where you're going to go ahead and do the expansion now?
That's the location for the expansion, yeah.
So you're done with, you were looking at another group that was going to provide you LNG down at Houston and going to almost give it to you, and you chose not to take that, the cheap gas?
Well, that's not really an accurate statement.
That's the rumor I've heard on the street. I don't know. I think Gary Wilkin was mentioning it to me.
Unfortunately, if they were willing to give us LNG, I would be the first in line and take as much as they could give me, as often as they could give me. But we weren't able to come to a conclusion of an agreement that made sense for either party. You know, as you get into the details of these discussions, what gets talked about early on, you know, maybe promises made or indications given, don't always bear fruit at the end of the day once you get into the real details of a discussion, and unfortunately that one did not.
So the cheap gas was not cheap gas at the end?
It was not cheap gas that actually existed.
Oh, the gas did not exist?
There was no gas, cheap gas, to put in the start of that system that would have ultimately resulted in delivery.
Then why did they waste all your time?
You know, we've moved.
Sorry about that.
It's just the detail. Yeah.
And free gas may not be secure gas. And one thing we've considered is we want to make sure we can get gas to those houses and businesses at 60 below, pretty much under any condition.
Right.
You know, we don't want to freeze up Fairbanks. So sometimes getting gas and having the risk associated with those gas supplies may not give you that kind of supply you really require. And so as we worked through those kind of details, a lot of conditions started changing, and it just didn't really come together.
Thank you. Moving on with the liquefaction process. So we, as part of that, issued RFPs for the liquefaction and pretreatment, the storage tanks that would go along with it, and unloading racks and power generation. We're actually going to produce our own power at that location for the new expansion. We're quite pleased with the level of interest. We received 10 proposals in our initial RFP for that liquefaction, and we've now finalized our review and will be issuing shortly our notice of intent. We haven't issued that yet, so I can't let you know who that is, but it'll be coming soon as to who our chosen liquefaction and pretreatment vendor will be. With that piece of the puzzle done, we can now move to our next stage of engineering, and we're going to take it to a 65% engineering design to get us to a plus or minus 10% on our budget, and then decide if we take it to 100% engineering before contracting the work or do a design build for the remaining piece. We're scheduled to complete that FEED work by the end of 2019, so in the next 2 months. Once that's done, we can be in a position for the IGU board to consider a final investment decision for that liquefaction expansion. I'll talk about some of the financing needs we have that we're working on that's part of the liquefaction project that's necessary before we move forward. Any questions on the liquefaction? So our largest project that we've had underway since we really started kicking off the execution of the Interior Energy Project versus the planning is the large storage project in Fairbanks. And as Director Wilkin actually coined it, it's the heart of the Interior Energy Project. This storage tank provides the security of supply into the future as the chair just referenced, Chair Higginson just referenced, our board and management takes very seriously our commitment to our customers in providing a high level of secure supply. This tank is one of the things that does that. It will be the security supply for the entire system. So the North Pole facility, we have the ability to withdraw LNG from this tank and transfer it to North Pole if we had some sort of catastrophic disruption of our delivery mechanism from Point McKenzie into Fairbanks for some extended period. So we would still be able to transfer and keep both facilities operational. So as I said, it's a 5.25 million gallon capacity tank, and that's about 0.45 billion cubic feet, just to put that in perspective. It is a double-walled, double-containment design, and in the LNG industry, that's the safest tank design that you can select for your facility. We commenced construction on January 1st of 2018, and we have a completion date scheduled of mid-November and commissioning to begin right in mid-November through December, with the tank being filled in November and December. The tank itself is complete, as you can see in this picture here in the background. It has been for a couple of months, and we've been focusing on the balance of plant, the piping, instrumentation, electrical, required for the other components. The tank itself, let's see if I've got some additional detail. The outer wall is 10-inch thick concrete precast panels. Those panels were precast in Anchorage at Anchorage Sand and Gravel and delivered to Fairbanks by truck. After the outer wall was put up, there's 400 miles of wire winding around this tank in various layers. So it's wind it, shotcrete, wind it, shotcrete, wind it, shotcrete. So very robust construction. The dome roof was built on site and lifted in a single lift and put in place. That was done. It allowed us to move inside in the first through the winter and use the tank as our shop. So the inner tank was built all winter. That's what has allowed us to maintain our aggressive schedule. An important part of our schedule is having it in service prior to January 1st of 2020 to qualify for State of Alaska storage tax credits. And for this project, that's up to $15 million storage tax credit eligibility. The legislature does still need to appropriate funds to cover those, but we will qualify for that storage tax credit for this project.
What is the investment in the tank, Dan?
About $56
million. Yeah. The tax credits are to recover some of that money, is that?
That's correct. And it's because we're a non-taxpaying entity, the credits can also be a payment. So if you're a non-profit like we are, owned by the borough, we can receive payment in lieu of a tax credit. Yeah. Those were put in place as part of the Cook Inlet Recovery Act and the exploration incentives. There was a storage tax credit put in place for, I don't know if you're familiar with the Singza project, the underground storage in the Anchorage area that provides the security supply for Anchorage now. That was the first, there was a natural gas storage tax credit put in place that project qualified for and received. And then as we began the interior energy project, it was expanded to include an LNG project as well. So what you see here is a couple pictures of some of the other components of the plant. The picture on my left, and I guess it depends where you are, everybody's left, is the offload skid. So the trucks come in on a concrete pad. They hook up to this skid where the LNG is pumped into the tank. This skid also allows us to pump directly into our vaporizers if for some reason we had to isolate the tank from our vaporizers. So that's another one of those security of supply components.
How many trucks to fill it up?
500. About 500 trucks to fill the tank. Each one of our trucks carries about 10 to 12,500 gallons.
Do you have all your own tractors and all your own drivers?
No. We own the trailers. We own the LNG specialized trailers, and we contract out the trucks and drivers. So
independents, just the JIPOs?
Nope. We're using Big State Logistics. They've had our contract for the last few years. We just did an updated RFP in June, and they were the successful bidder again. So we have a three-year contract with Big State. We do own two LNG-powered tractors that we lease back to Big State. They operate them on our behalf. So two of the trucks that haul our LNG are powered by LNG. And that's something, we'll look forward to into the future on expanding that in both our business and hopefully others in the state.
How do they work in the winter?
They work fine in the winter. We have had some operating challenges related to some of the pumps and things like that. But, the LNG gets vaporized. And so the cold weather doesn't have a direct impact on ability to vaporize some of the components. We also have the opportunity to use CNG. And back to one of your questions, Mr. Chair, is the borough passed a resolution where they would look to convert their bus fleet to CNG. And endorsed the conversion of the assembly endorsed the conversion of that bus fleet to CNG, which is one of those things that helps us with demand. The other picture there is some of the balance of plant. So the green roof you see, that's where we have our boil-off gas compression. There's three boil-off gas compressors, each one 50% capacity, so we have a full redundancy. Just to the right of it, you can see that, hopefully you can see those three pipes sticking up. Those are our vaporizers. Again, we have three 50% units. And the building in the background is the multipurpose building, which is houses the controls and the heat source for the vaporization, all of our motor control centers, and the air and nitrogen generation for our control system. Any questions on that? Just on your website and ours is a really good time lapse. If you get an opportunity, I didn't put it in here today. It would take a little more time than probably what we wanted. You can take a look at that time lapse video when you get a chance. It's really pretty neat to see the tank go up.
The CO2 foundation cooling.
Oh yeah, sorry. Just one of the details in there is this facility. We're going to keep the ground frozen for the entire life of the facility. So there's been a lot of work done on the geotechnical. So at the start of construction, we put a ground loop cooling system in that was driven by a refrigeration compressor, a small one, to keep the ground frozen. And now we have a ground loop system around the tank that we are cross-exchanging with the boil-off gas. The boil-off gas is extremely cold, minus 220, and cross-exchanging that with water glycol for the cooling to keep the ground frozen for the life of the facility. So we are using some of the energy available out of the cold LNG.
Not much, though.
No. And we might have an opportunity for some more in the future. The next is our North Pole storage project. And that's 150,000-gallon capacity. We're going to reuse two tanks that are in existing operation in Fairbanks. We closed on the purchase of about 20 acres from GVA in September and started the groundwork construction on October 1st. We've completed our deep dynamic compaction related to the project, all that passed, and they're finalizing bringing the pad up to grade so it's ready for construction activities in the spring. That one's HC. Yeah.
That's going fast.
Yeah.
I mean, really fast.
And we've got out for bid right now the site infrastructure work, which would be the placement of the tanks, all the civil works, the building, and et cetera. But the groundwork will be completed so the site infrastructure contractor can start as soon as possible.
Do you have a commitment from Golden Valley to use that gas in the summer?
I would call it a commitment in concept. They've indicated publicly several times that they are committed to using gas in their facility, but there's some caveats to that, provided the price is right, is basically the caveat. And so we're continuing to work with Golden Valley. This facility is right across the street from their power generation facility in North Pole, right across the old Flint Hills refinery and near the Petrostar refinery that's there. So it's on H&H Road for those familiar with that area. So it's in a prime location to be able to provide service to Golden Valley.
Is this contaminated ground, contaminated from out there at the refinery?
No, most of the contamination went the other direction, so this area was not. No. We did our...
Phase one audit?
Yeah, we did phase one work prior to the closing of the purchase. Yeah. This one I've got, this is a rendering of the... project. I'll do a quick flyover it for you. So you can see right there, H&H Road. We'll have another multi-purpose building that's on the right there for our heat and the components for the controls and control room. Two 75,000-gallon tanks with space to add an additional two. The site itself would allow us to install a field-directed large tank if Golden Valley wanted a larger storage capacity, so we could still put this on this general site. So that's what it'll look like, an offload station similar to the one in Fairbanks when constructed. Let's see. So on the distribution side, in Fairbanks, as I mentioned, we've got 140 miles of distribution piping, currently serving about 1,150 customers, and I'm pleased to say we're adding customers to that. We've added, I'll cover that in a bit, but 50 customers just this summer in preparation for the availability of more supply from the LNG storage tank. As you can see from this map, we've got a pretty wide coverage backbone in the Fairbanks core area that we can incrementally build off in the future. So we have a substantial customer base to begin installing service lines to. As I mentioned, in the Fairbanks service area this year, we put in 29 new residential service lines, 15 commercial and 6 interruptible. And the interruptible can start taking service right away. The rest of them will be able to provide service as soon as we get enough stored LNG in our tank to give them the secure supply that we need. So that should be sometime in the March-April timeframe.
When do you run out of the tank you built? You're going to be putting new customers online. When do you have to build another tank? What year?
It's not part of our current 20-year capital plan or performa. So beyond
you're
that.
You're going to be sold out way before 20 years.
Well, so
10 years.
Sold out kind of in phases, so to speak. So as we add liquefaction, that first phase, 100,000 gallons a day, we actually have the ability to add 400,000 gallon a day plants at that location. And the feed work, I failed to mention, is contemplating two additions. So the engineering work we right now will prepare us to be able to add a second 100,000 gallon a day train quickly if we need to. Take an example, Golden Valley says, you know what, you guys have proven yourself, you've got your storage projects done, we see the liquefaction now, we want to convert the LM6000, we want 100,000 gallons a day of liquid. We can pull the trigger on that next expansion and have it done fairly quickly.
Have you found enough gas to be able to do that? Do you have a gas supply in mind?
We're out in the market right now. We've actually contracted with Anchorage contractor, MAP Consulting, that's right now contacting all the potential suppliers. And so with the goal to, in the next few months, to have solidified a gas supply for our next tranche.
I see that was $100,000, up to $100,000 contract.
No, the contract itself actually has a base monthly fee that's pretty modest. It's $5,000 a month. That's the retainer fee. They're pretty dedicated to the work that it's doing. There is a success fee that, depending on the price of gas, has different ranges. So if our price of gas is $6, the success fee and is $40,000 to $50,000. I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head. If it's $4, if our price of gas is $4 compared to our current price of $7.72 today, then there's a $100,000 success fee, and I would be very happy to sign that check and deliver it personally, because if we receive $4 gas, that saves us as an entity millions and millions of dollars.
Well, there's not more than a dozen people you can buy from, right, probably?
Yeah.
So couldn't you just got on the phone, invited them all over for pizza and beer and had a talk? Save yourself $100,000?
Well, potentially, but, you know.
The details, Bernie.
So
I'm just asking.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty focused on a lot of the projects we have going on, and within our entity, I'm the one individual that has the most experience with gas supply contracts in the inlet. It's always good to have somebody with a few different contacts and a different perspective, and to make sure we haven't overlooked an opportunity that may exist or a approach that I haven't thought about. So I think it's money well spent on behalf of our entity, given the other projects we're focused on and the potential for savings. And, you know, if we don't get there and we sign a contract that's more similar to what we have today, there is no success fee, and we would have paid a modest fee for the assistance necessary to gather all that information. So in my view, it's money well spent.
So, thank you.
So, Dan, your distribution is limited right now until you get storage. Is that correct?
Right. So these ones are essentially being pre-installed so that when the storage is filled, the storage project, the LNG storage project, if we didn't expand our liquefaction facility, allows us to start serving new customers. We can add an additional 400,000 MCF of sales to our current base, which is, we sell right now approximately 800,000 MTF a year, so about 50% addition. And the way we can do that is we can, our liquefaction plant right now in the summer, we'll shut it off for 3 or 4 days because we have no, our demand drops. Our demand between winter and summer is one truck a day in the summer, six trucks a day in the winter, order of magnitude. And so in the summertime, we don't have any place for that liquid. What we'll do moving forward is we'll continue to operate that facility, liquefy the gas, transport it, and store it, and have it available in the winter when the peak goes up, and we can use that tank to deliver additional supplies. And so the tank itself plays a big role in increasing utilization of liquefaction assets also.
When do you anticipate the tank being full?
So in our current fiscal year budget, which is fiscal year 2000, which ends the end of June, we anticipate having about 2.5 million gallons in it. We'll see how much what our demand is at the time, whether we want to fill it or whether we're comfortable at that level. We can have it full prior to the next winter season.
So you're saying you need additional capacity beyond that?
This tank gives us the ability to add customers because it essentially adds capacity to our system through the ability to fill it and withdraw. So fill it in the off season, draw it down in the peak season.
So it's this tank that gives you the capacity. You're not talking about new.
The tank is our first capacity addition. The liquefaction expansion is our second addition. So if we didn't do any liquefaction expansion and we added that 400,000 MCF of sales, we would be too blocked. Again, that would take us to our point of our security supply profile that we couldn't add any more customers without jeopardizing that.
But you could still add 50%.
We can add that 50%.
Without the additional liquefaction.
Yeah.
Okay.
We can. And to put that in perspective, that quantity of gas, if it was all residential customers, is about 2,600 residential customers. Now, our makeup isn't all residential. We'll have some commercial customers use a lot more energy than residential customers. So depending on the makeup, we'll dictate the actual customer numbers. But if it was all residential, it'd be about 2,600. And we serve about 600 residential customers today. Our customer mix numbers is about 50% residential, 50% commercial. On a demand basis, it's less than 10% residential, 90% commercial. This is North Pole. As I said, we put in about 70 miles of pipe in the North Pole area, broken out into three zones. This is a high consequence area for air pollution in North Pole, one of them. And so conversion to gas here will be a significant help to the air quality issue. And as soon as we get that storage facility in place, we can begin adding customers here. So our next is our financing, our status on the financing activities. So the original $125 million of SETS funds, which was part of the Interior Energy Project, we expect to have fully drawn by the first quarter of 2020. Ada and IGU, thank you to this board, recently executed an additional $10 million of financing that's part of that finance agreement that is allowing us to move forward with the North Pole project and installing mains and service lines. So that's been done and we're moving forward. We have completed a credit presentation and site visits to Fitch as part of a planned bond issuance in 2019, first part of 2020. Actually, our new target date is in the end of January time frame of 2020, where we think we'll be looking to issue about a $60 million par issuance for our first bond offering. As part of the Interior Energy Project, there was up to $150 million of bond availability through conduit revenue bonds through ADA. Those funds would be used primarily for the liquefaction expansion, about $50 million for liquefaction expansion, and then the remaining would be for additional services and meters and minor distribution system infill. So $50 million liquefaction and $10 million in the service line meters and minor infill work. As part of our preparation for that, IGU has contracted with a financial advisor that has significant experience in Fairbanks. They just actually closed a bond financing with, they were working with the Tanaw Chiefs. I think you guys were involved and heard from them on that. We've got our underwriters and bond counsel on board as well. So, as I said, targeting an issuance in the end of January for that.
Are you allowed to say who those people are?
Yeah, Hilltop Securities is our financial advisor. Specifically, the lead on that is Mike Newman. Our bond counsel is Mark Greeno with Foster & Pepper, who has a lot of experience in bond work in Alaska. And then our underwriter team is led by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. And then we also have in different and more of a junior role, who is that other two, excuse me. It'll come to me in a second. But, yeah, they're the lead. And then the other two are more of, rather than institutional, more just general commercial, attractive. It'll come to me.
We call that a senior moment, Dan.
It is. It's, you know, I got to, you know, I was like,
we're all guilty of it.
The first tranche of our first estimated bond placement was $60 million par value. Yeah. So our next steps, we'll continue to advance the natural gas conversion program. So some of the things we're doing there is we're updating our marketing plan. We've recently gone through kind of a rebranding exercise. We've, you know, reestablished our logo, kind of what our tagline's going to be as we move forward and generate some of our marketing materials. We're getting back together a conversion group that's made up of banks, conversion contractors, general public, and city, borough officials, to brainstorm and work on together on ways to make sure the conversions are as easy and cost-effective as possible. We will continue to the implementation of the combined utility integration and transition plan. So the two utilities combined, I was the former CEO with Fairbanks Natural Gas and have taken, just signed a new agreement with IGU, so a new 3-year commitment with IGU. And so the staff of the operating utility is taking on the role of now operating the utility itself, reporting to the IGU Board of Directors. We will be transitioning to a single name, the Interior Gas Utility. We will be closing the separate entities up as we move that through the process. We are constantly refining our master schedule. As you can see, we have a lot of things going on, and there's something happening significantly in every piece of our business. So our master schedule, given IGU is a relatively new utility, we have a lot of policy development to continue to work through over the years. So that'll be ongoing. We'll finalize the liquefaction feed work I discussed. And then, as mentioned earlier, we're advancing the natural gas feedstock availability and negotiations for our next level of supply. And our public relations and marketing. We've been, as we finalize these projects, you know, we're kind of quiet out in the neighborhood, but you're starting to see that message ramp up. We had a good article about a week ago that talked about the advancements of our projects, and we're now that we will have gas available for customers at a definitive date certain, we can start to ramp up that message and really start to create the excitement that of the project that we have ongoing. Excuse me.
How much would it cost to connect South Central to the interior with the pipeline?
So that's a good question, and it depends who you ask. But from my perspective, you know, we used to have an old adage was natural gas transmission pipeline is about $1 million a mile. That does not hold true anymore. Most gas pipeline projects we're seeing $2-3 million a mile more in today's world. And so you know, we're talking 300 miles plus for that connection, so probably $1 billion or more. To complete that connection, just the transmission line itself.
And how much has been spent since 1998 on interior natural gas?
So up until the Interior Energy Project, anything that was spent was all private funds, private investment. And in over the that time frame, $60 million or so in the infrastructure that was in place, probably. Between the liquefaction, the two storage facilities, distribution expansion, and service lines, all of that activity. the monies that have been spent related to the Interior Energy Project are that there was a capital appropriation of $57 million. $15 million of that was expended on advancing LNG supplies from the North Slope that didn't pan out. $42 million of that capital appropriation was used in the purchase of the Pentex, so $42 million of that was used. And then we've got $125 million that will be expended in the next number of months. And what's been accomplished with that is the other portion of the purchase of Pentex, the installation of the 140 miles of distribution piping, the construction of the Fairbanks storage facility, and just some other minor activities related to advancing the project. So much less than the $1 billion. And a lot of what we're spending the money on would be in addition to the $1 billion. So the storage, or excuse me, the distribution piping network, that's in addition to the $1 billion I was mentioning earlier. That would have to be done regardless of the source of supply. So all the work we're doing today is all, we'll call it pipeline supply ready and supportive. So if there is a large pipeline built from the North Slope, the work we're doing on this project is supportive of and supplementary to a pipeline supply. I've been asked the question, you know, well, the storage projects, isn't LNG storage, isn't that going to be a waste? It's not going to be needed in a pipeline supply. Well, first, we'll have a single source of supply from a pipeline, so having a backup is a good idea and something that will be valuable. Secondarily is when you purchase demand from a pipeline, you have to purchase it based on your peak if you don't have some other means to meet your peak. So a lot of utilities in Canada and the U.S. have peak shaving LNG facilities. So in the peak winter weeks or days, they supplement their supply with the delivery of product out of the LNG system. That allows them to reduce their demand charges on the pipeline for the rest of the year. And so it plays an economic role in distribution system in the future.
But Dan, I would correct me if I'm wrong here. I would call the LNG storage facility an interim portion of a larger energy plan for the interior Fairbanks. And then, would you be able to use that LNG facility for outlier communities like Nenana or Delta Junction, Salcha, or even Toke? Any of those?
Yeah, exactly. And it'll serve two purposes. It'll be the peak shaver and security supply for the interior, for Fairbanks area. But secondarily, it can be a hub for other areas of the state that don't get access to pipeline gas. You know, we've worked on a lot of different remote areas.
Chino
Springs. Chino. That's right. Well, cool is hot water.
Get rid of that cheap hydro.
Yeah. But one thing I didn't talk about, we have started, you know, we do have some service in other remote areas. We've been serving the Talkeetna Lodge for 20 years. That's a 200-room lodge in Talkeetna. We have a small storage and vaporization facility there. So that model can be replicated elsewhere. We did actually work on a project with Toke, the power company there. They converted one of their diesel generators for a period of time and was using natural gas. And that's something that we're looking to expand in the future. So lastly, I got to leave you with our safety message for all of you in the construction industry or digging at home. Make sure, please.
One this year.
Good. Well, hopefully next year it'll be none. Make sure you're calling 811 before you're digging, whether it's in your yard or as part of your business. All gas utilities do free locates, whether it's us in Fairbanks or those in Anchorage. NSTAR will do a free locate and come and locate our facilities. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of our message is safety around gas systems that is driven by our regulator, the federal government, Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Advisory Group. And so it's something we work hard on and look to, you know, consistently provide a safe, reliable service to our customers.
Have you had any lost time accidents in all the years you've been in business up there?
Lost time as far as we've had lost time personnel incidents where somebody's injured a shoulder or twisted the back. We have not had any fire or explosion in Fairbanks related to natural gas release, or any fire, explosion, or property damage related to natural gas release on the transport corridor. You know, we've had it. Yeah, so we've got an excellent safety record related to those activities. The tanks themselves, just quick, you know, an LNG tank, when you see one on the road, the outer tank that you see actually isn't containing any of the LNG. There's an annular space filled with insulation and then an inner tank that's containing the product. And so LNG systems have a very high level of safety built into the code requirements from the beginning of operation.
What kind of boil-off do you have putting it in the tank and bringing it to Fairbanks? Any?
We do, yeah. We'll have boil-off. Our highest point of boil-off is when we're doing the transfer from the trailers into the tank. And then once the LNG is in there, it kind of reaches a steady state and starts boiling off slowly. And so our boil-off is well below what our consumption is, so we won't have any release. It'll all be compressed and put into our distribution system. In a peak shaving LNG tank, they care about boil off. It's really important to them because they want to liquefy all the gas in the summer and then hold on to it until that winter week or couple days. We're consuming it all the time, so the boil off isn't that big of a deal for us in our situation.
Yeah, and what just for the board's information, how engaged are the three government entities that allow you to be a utility, i.e. the City of North Pole, Assembly up there, the City Council, the Mayor, the North Star Borough, and the City of Fairbanks and its council?
So I would say very engaged. We provide quarterly updates to the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The borough owns the Interior Gas Utility. We are part of their annual audit. The chair just participated in their audit committee, so our financials get rolled into their audit. And so they're engaged. So quarterly, I'm providing them updates and presentations. Our current administration is in the borough and the cities. The mayors are very supportive and actively participate. And so they're engaged and they're looking at opportunities to help when they can. And the example being the bus fleet issue, and the mayor is looking at other opportunities for things like borough buildings to have that same philosophy. So borough buildings would switch to gas when available. A lot of them are today. A lot of the schools have converted to gas when it's available. So we'll look to continue to advance that relationship with them.
And to add on to that, our board is made up of 7 board members. We have 3 of them that are appointed, one by the City of North Pole, one by the City of Fairbanks, and one by the North Star Borough. And then there's 4 that are elected. So, and this year, all 3 of them are, all 3 public members, or I guess appointed members, are up for reappointment. So they're, and it's not uncommon to have mayor from North Pole stop by a meeting, you know, weigh in on issues, give Dan a call, talk to him. So they're very engaged because they're looking for a solution to this air quality problem we have in Fairbanks. And I think this is a big part of that.
One thing I'll add, if I could, it's an important part of IGU's formation, the enabling ordinances. You know, some borough-owned utilities, example being the ones here in Anchorage, actually dividend back excess revenues margin to the assembly for other uses. The Interior Gas Utility, its enabling ordinance, doesn't allow for that. So all of the funds, all of the revenues generated by this project get reinvested in this project for the purpose it was formed. And so that's an important aspect of our project, that there won't be funds moved for other purposes from the utility. That's dedicated to the utility and to our mission. The project now has been through with SB 23, HB 105, and then reauthorization of the bond in 2018, been through multiple legislatures and multiple administrations, so has received a high level of support from the legislature and the administration over a number of years. including other aspects like PACE legislation for on-bill financing legislation, other aspects. That was just last, PACE was last year. Not this legislative session, just closed the one prior to that. Still a high level of support for overall. I did have a great opportunity to tour a number of our interior delegation and others as they were in Fairbanks for AFN, the large storage project, so we took that opportunity. So, with that, that concludes my presentation. Happy to answer more questions, and thank you very much for your time. I probably ran longer than you wanted, but a lot of stuff to cover.
But then I have one last question, at least at this point. So the existing operating utility, so you talked about all your expansions and the work in progress. So your existing operating utility as it stands right now, since IG purchased it from ADA, is it positive cash flow? Is still doing what you anticipated it would do, after the purchase? Is your business plan, is that still all the same?
Yep, or still positive cash flow contribution. So any of our capital improvements or operating capital replacements, those are covered by operating cash flow, not by new debt. New debt is for new infrastructure, the expansion. So we're continuing to meet that. So our cash flow is covering our expenses and our capital improvements for existing operating assets. And so we continue to deliver on that day in and day out. And so that's, but we've had a couple over some challenging times too. The weather has been warm. And so the last couple of years, last year alone, we were 20% behind on heating degree days in the interior, but we still managed to generate positive cash flows, manage expenses in accordance with what's going on.
Were you able to keep most of your employees through this transition?
We have been able to keep most of our employees. We've had a high level of retention. We do have some natural attrition. We're not the highest payer in the utility industry. There's a lot of much larger established utilities with a larger customer base, and sometimes we lose people to that we just can't chase some of that. But we've maintained all of our key management staff and key operation personnel, and continue to have a high level of retention. So we have brought on a couple of new positions in preparation for our growth. One is the director of operations as we expand our assets. And then given we've taken over the IGU facilities, we have personnel that used to be a contract employee for IGU that does a lot of the board activities. And as you know, preparing for these board meetings and things like that is a substantial amount of work. And then given the high importance of conversions, we brought on a conversion and customer service manager that's focused on, we'll call them, new customer acquisition.
Well, I'd like to congratulate the board on having a high level of intelligence to retain you for another 3 years. That shows a very high level of intelligence. So, Steve, congratulations to you and the board for that. And I really want to congratulate all of you because, I mean, we're going to have a utility. I mean, and we're going to have gas in Fairbanks. And there's a lot of doubting Thomases out there. So, kudos for proving them wrong.
If you go to somebody in Fairbanks and say, gas is almost here, they'll go back to that poster on the Fedco wall that says 1956, gas is coming. There's a lot of naysayers about that, and they always go back to that spot, but it's actually coming, and it'll be here this spring. So
thanks, Don.
Yeah, I know. It's happening. Yeah. It will happen. So we're really happy to hear that. So also before we go away, Dan mentioned that we give a lot of dignitaries and different people tours, and I want to personally invite each of you to come to Fairbanks for a tour. It's an impressive thing. You can see pictures. I've been on several tours myself. It does not capture the size or the magnitude of this project. It's a big
commitment from Tom. He says he's going to go up. I'm going to go up with him.
You're all invited, staff's included. But we'll go out there and we'll take you through the site and show.
I imagine when your new baby is born, when you're filling it up, I imagine you're going to be handing out cigars. It's a girl. I didn't say boy.
Hopefully we'll get an opportunity for a ribbon cutting once we've kind of get it commissioned and got some LNG in there, and we'd love to you know, at that time, take the opportunity for the tour.
Well, but before we close this on this presentation, I want to give a quick shout out to our former executive director, Ted Leonard. He kind of put the foundation in place for the IGU to begin with, and so he deserves some credit to put that together. And for that, we're very appreciative of it, and I assume Fairbanks is too. But Ted's now in a different spot. Now he's going to harass us from the valley as an assembly member out there, which we look forward to hearing all about. So if there's no further questions, I'm going to thank you for your presentation. Thank the IGU board members who are online through all this, their participation. And I'm going to take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll rejoin the board meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
We're freezing it. We're freezing it. Hey, Chris.
Hello?
Back in order, and nice presentation by IGU. That brings us up to item number B, loan resolution L19-11 Seward Wildlife Center Cruises LLC. Tom?
Yep, thank you very much. 7B, and I'll ask Chris Anderson to come up, and while she's coming up, I'll just make a few comments. I want the board to approve this $8.1 million loan participation. Strong borrowers, experienced in the industry. This board is pretty darn familiar with the tourism industry and the subset of the tourism industry, the cruise ship industry. The only other thing I'll add before Chris explains this is in these loan participations, ADA has now hit its interest rate floor. So even if interest rates continue downward for some period of time, as some people certainly expect, ADA has hit a floor, so you won't see lower interest rates in this program. The next change that you see out of interest rates in this program will be whenever interest rates are back up again.
What is the interest rate on this loan?
It actually is up just slightly. It's 3.41.
That's excellent. Yeah. My goodness.
It couldn't be
better.
Yeah. It's a good rate.
And that's a 25-year fixed?
Yes, 25-year fixed.
I wish I had something to refinance.
Well, welcome.
Okay.
Chris?
Okay. Is this on, off? This is on? Yeah, okay, thanks.
Can you speak up?
Yeah, thank you.
Speak up.
Okay.
Says that our mics aren't very good.
Oh, all right.
Speak more in. Thank you.
Speak into the microphone. Oh, there we go. Okay. All right. Well, as
I can hear you guys, it's fine.
Thank you, Julie.
This loan participation request is from FNBA First National, a gross loan amount of $9 million, and we would be participating 90%, which is $8.1 million. To these Seward Wildlife Cruises LLC. It's loan resolution number L19-11. We would be giving a 25-year fixed rate on our portion of the loan, and FNBA is giving them 20 years at a variable rate.
What is that? What's it start out at?
I know the rate, but the lender doesn't always want that to be public. We haven't usually made it public in the past.
Can you give me a blended rate?
I haven't blended the rate, but I can do something off the top here. I would say the blended rate would be approximately 4.2%. As I indicated, the borrower is Seward Wildlife Cruises, LLC. The co-borrower is Gateway 82, LLC, which is the operating entity. That's 100% owned by Seward Wildlife Cruises, LLC. The guarantors involved are Four Seasons Marine Services Corporation, which manages the marine and tour-related businesses, and Thomas and Mary Tugas and TMT Trust. Just to let you know, Mr. Tugas is here today. The use of the proceeds would be to pay off FNBA's construction loan, as well as the closing costs. The project itself is an 80-room hotel, Seward Gateway Hotel, located in Seward, and the jobs affiliated with this are 30 construction jobs and 35 new jobs that will be created. Management of the project will be professionally managed by Tom Tugas and Kyle Nichols, who is the current general manager of Harbor 360 Hotel, which is a sister property that they will share maintenance, front desk, and housekeeping staff, as well as management. The collateral involved, we would take a first deed of trust position on the property. The project was appraised by Brian Bethard at $12,382,000 for the real estate and $918,000 for the FF&E, which is furniture, fixtures, and equipment, which provides a 73% loan-to-value based on just the real estate alone, which is well within the ADA guidelines. The projected net operating income for 2019 that was proposed by the appraisal gives us a debt service coverage of 1.95 to 1, our minimum being 1.25 to 1. There are no known environmental issues. And in regards to the market, most of you are familiar with Seward. It is certainly tourism-based and has continued to grow at a very good pace with over 100 cruise ships that were scheduled for this season in 2019. The combination of tour buses, train passengers, and road travelers have made Seward a destination throughout the summer. And one of the barriers for the bus tour companies is a limited availability of quality accommodations. Premier Tours has committed to increase their presence if they can secure accommodations. This combined with high occupancy rates for Harbor 360, which is, again, their sister hotel in close proximity to this, supports the need for additional hotel rooms. The management infrastructure is in place with the same ownership structure. This new hotel will have the support of the reservation system, the housekeeping and maintenance for the Harbor 360 hotel, and the new hotel will contract with Alaska Travel Bureau. In Anchorage, which will provide sales, marketing, and reservation support for the hotel. The strengths that we saw in this credit are the fact that it's new construction, they have experienced management, and they have a strong market demand. Perceived weaknesses.
Is there a construction lender?
First National is a construction lender. Okay. Weaknesses or perceived weaknesses could be the fact that it's seasonal operations. It's a non-flagged hotel, but there's no real risk beyond market risk. And it has been mentioned that it's not solely dependent, the hotel industry down there, on tourism, but there's a lot of marine repair that goes on in Seward, and those people need some place to stay. So that also accommodates the hotel industry there. In regards to portfolio diversification, these numbers are as of 6/30/19. Total dollars in the Gulf Coast region as a percentage of ADA's total portfolio statewide would increase from 4.32% to 6.09% with this loan. ADA has 11.3% of its total statewide portfolio in the tourism industry, and this would increase to 12.93%. And for participated loans solely within the Gulf Coast region, 54.31% is attributed to tourism, and that would increase to 68.13%. I do have some comments here on the degree of completion, but keep in mind that this write-up was completed on October 8th, so it has actually progressed past this. And Mr. Tugas is here if you would like to talk to him about the actual degree of construction. But at that point in time, they were complete with the sewer and water connection. The forms and footings were set with concrete scheduled to be poured that following week for the hotel portion and then also for the conference area. Completion for the hotel itself is scheduled to be May 1st of 2020. We have not inspected it to date, but we would certainly go down and inspect it at its completion and before we fund the loan. So staff does recommend this loan for approval, and with that, I would open it for any questions that you have.
Thank you, Chris. Questions from the board?
I would just like to ask one. If this money was not available, reasonable money from Ada, would they have still done this project, or would they have not looked at it?
Well, yes, this is Tim Redder from First National Bank in Kenai. And if the Board of Ada would not approve the long-term financing, First National has approved the construction and permanent financing for this project.
So the answer is yes.
Yes.
Okay. Chris, and this is kind of more related to all the hotels in general, would you be so kind at our next board meeting to give us a list of all the hotels we finance and where they're at?
Certainly.
I think it would be for the board to understand what, I mean, just
where they're physically at?
Where they're physically at.
Yeah, okay, sure.
You know, put it on a map, whatever, individually with a list. It would be kind of nice to see that, how many loans that Ada has done on hotels.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay.
A question.
Go ahead, Julie.
So I'm not familiar with the hotels and how they contract with the cruise industries, but do they have any contracts in place to supply X amount of rooms or X amount of date for the cruise industry or people that will be utilizing the facility and sewers?
This particular facility? Well, this facility is going to be a seasonal facility, so they're going to be open from about, I think, the third week of May or second week of May until the third week of September. But you're asking if there are contracts in place to date? I would probably have to ask Mr. Tugas that, which we can do. He is here, if you would like to know that.
It'd be interesting.
He'd have to come up and state his name and affiliation for the record, please.
Sure.
Welcome.
Good morning.
I'm Tom Tugas. I've lived in Seward for about 28 years, but as far as contracts, we primarily work through Premier and Alaska Tour and Travel and Alaska Travel Bureau, and we have long-term contracts with those entities. We are primarily we own the major marine tours, and we turn away lots and lots of customers because of lack of hotel rooms. We ask a lot of groups come to us, and they won't book a tour until they have secured their overnight accommodations. And for that reason, in 2015, we bought what was the Holiday Inn Express in Seward and converted it to the Harbor 360. And at that time, I told her there was a comment about flagging on the hotel, and I told our staff the number one goal is to be rated number one on TripAdvisor within 6 weeks, and within 4 weeks, we were the number one rated hotel on TripAdvisor. And the world has changed, so in today's world, it's all about your ratings on these independent things like TripAdvisor. So we got rid of the Holiday Inn Express flag. They had been paying over $300,000 a year to use that name, and the next year our revenues went up 11%. So we found that having the flag really didn't make any difference. It was all about the customer ratings you got. So that's really our focus. And Seward, people think about the cruise ships, but cruise ships are only about 22% of our business. Our biggest market is what we call VFRs, visiting friends and relatives. And so people, as all of you have friends and relatives that come to Alaska to see glaciers and whales, and that's what we do, is we take Alaskans out and show them the glaciers and whales. But yes, we do have relationships with all of the major tour operators.
So will this be a year-round facility, open year-round, 365 days a year?
No, our current hotel, the Harbor 360, is open year-round, 365 days a year. But, of course, our peak is in the summer, and the current hotel accommodates, in the winter we're doing about 60% occupancy, and a lot of that is marine repair. I always say Seward is a tourism town in the summer, and it's a marine repair town in the winter. So we get really busy in the spring because all the boats that are going out to Western Alaska to haul fuel and groceries and things are all in a hurry to get their vessels ready to go. And then the summer, of course, takes care of itself. Our slowest time is the fall, but in the winter, all those boats, you know, right now, this time of year, all the boats that are out in western Alaska, whether they're fishing boats or fuel boats, fuel barges, are all coming back to Seward. And so the hotel gets busy. So, but there's plenty of capacity in the current hotel. So this is actually a supplemental hotel. This is a sister hotel to our current hotel.
So the boat repair is actually a huge driver in the wintertime down in Seward then?
Absolutely.
Would you say that that's one of the main industries in town then in the winter?
I would say that in the winter, it is definitely the number one winter activity in Seward.
And yet they repair a lot of those boats. They do a lot of work outside. They're out in the weather repairing boats, right? I mean, they don't.
Yes.
It's amazing. I compliments to Seward and to your marine repair because you guys make it happen.
Uh-huh.
You know, kudos to you.
Okay, Greg?
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on Bernie's first question. So this loan, can you kind of characterize or describe your motivation for seeking aid or participation? Was it that it wouldn't have been economical had it just been bank financed, or what was your thinking behind it?
Well, this particular piece of land, I bought it and started making payments on it about 18 years ago and basically spent 15 years making payments on this piece of land. It's one of the few pieces of private land in the Seward Harbor area. And I've been waiting the last 3 or 4 years for both the demand and the financing to be appropriate. When I bought my first house in Fairbanks 40 years ago now, it was interest rates were 16 1/8. And so I'm very personally sensitive to interest rate opportunities. And, you know, the financing opportunities through ADA are attractive. As many of you may know, I'm also on the board of directors of FNBA. And so I could certainly have gotten a loan through FNBA, but the decision to go on it this year was largely driven by the financing opportunity. This year I also encouraged my daughter to buy a duplex in Seward because she could get a 3.5% interest rate. So I really believe that right now it was the opportunity because of the general condition of interest rates, but specifically through ADA. So I would say the timing was appropriate for us, both because of demand and because of the availability of this financing.
Dana, and I'd like to expand on that. Besides the lower interest rate, the stability of a fixed rate is probably
in term is
very attractive.
Yes, absolutely.
Local contractors?
We're using Criterion Construction. They just completed the Baxter Senior Living Facility, and actually before that they completed a hotel for Princess up in Denali. And so Criterion Construction out of Anchorage here is now, so the fellow who was the project manager on the Baxter Senior Living Facility is now down in Seward building this building.
Excellent.
All right, thank you. All right, so questions of Chris or Tom on this before? All right, I'll take a motion to put it on the floor.
I move resolution number L19-11.
I second it.
Further discussion? Seeing none, I'll call the board. Or Corinne, you want to pull the board, please?
Ms. Sandy.
Yes.
Mr. Commissioner Sembrinoski.
Yes.
Mr. Kidding.
Yes.
Mr. Vogel.
Yes.
Commissioner Anderson.
Yes.
Mr. Carl.
Yes.
Mr. Cruz.
Yes.
Motion carried.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Tugas brought some brochures. I didn't know
All
if
right.
I wanted them. I can pass them out if you,
you
want.
You bet.
Okay. Thank you.
I think what we'll do is so Tom, how long is resolution... How long is your presentation going to be on 19-21?
It can be very short. It's up to the board so far as...
see we have some Matsu people here.
Yeah.
So the reason why I'm saying that, should we go grab our lunches and eat while we do this? Is this going to be an hour? Is it going to be 30 minutes?
Mr. Chairman, on this resolution...
I mean, you've got Ambler, and you've got, I mean, it looks pretty
looks pretty, looks like there's a few things here.
Well, it depends on how much background you need as a board, of course, to fill in this money. Let, I can give you the Cliff Notes version, and you can decide. We do, of course, as you point out, we have...
I think because one is new, Wes is sitting there, we're going to grab lunch and eat while we're while you do this.
Okay.
Okay? So let's take 10 minutes, go grab lunch, come back, and we'll continue on with the board meeting. Any objections to that?
While we're getting lunch, I'll put the phones on mute.
We hope to have everything in place by the end of December and funding.
All right, so next up on our agenda is Resolution G19-21, pre-development work on potential access road project. Tom?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. 7 Charlie here, 7C. It's a request for money. It doesn't mean that we'll spend it all. Particularly in the Ambler case, but in the Ambler case, of Ambler is just to fill up the pipeline. With Ambler, we've got the people here to give an update on Ambler. I honestly don't think I wouldn't suggest we have the time unless the Energy Authority portion of the meeting is going to start after dinner. But we do have the Jeff San Juan has been. Attending all the BLM hearings on the EIS process. And, of course, Mark Davis drafted this resolution. The comment period on Ambler is going to end October 29. It was extended a couple of weeks. I've been updating the board in some of my communications to the board how that's going. Basically, this $718,000 is... aimed at quite a number of parts of Ambler, but principally we're going to commit to and establish a subsistence committee, just as we have on the DeLong Mountain Red Dog project, which has worked well from all aspects, and then late in the process, we've seen that we've got to deal more substantively with cultural resources. The second part of this resolution is an entirely different project, West Susitna Access, and we need for resources, and we need to get on the ground yet this fall. And the $50,000 that's in here for you to consider, that's a quarter of what will be, in this case, unlike the Ambler, this entire amount will undoubtedly be spent. So it's eight is in for a quarter, the Matsu Borough is in for a quarter, and then other funders are in for the other 50%. The urgency is just to get some work done in the field. Yet this fall, and because for this part we have guests, they should come first, so we'll reverse it from the order in the resolution, and we do have, as you said, Mr. Chairman, Ted Leonard and John Moosey from the borough, who were certainly the drivers of needing to, you know, wanting to get this done, and they've done a great job. And in the maps here in the packet and what you have,
up here,
you know, they're worth at least 2,000 words for me. And actually a number of people, including yourself, Mr. Chairman, and of course Bill Kendig, as well as the fellows, two fellows from the borough, have a heck of a lot more knowledge, about the area, than I do. But the origination of this access comes from Alaska Department of Transportation Road to Resources, and so some or all of these routes were identified some years ago by DOT. So certainly if Mr. Moosey and Mr. Leonard wanted to come up, they can speak a lot.
So without objection, with the board's concurrence, we can switch around to talk about West Susitna Access first.
Okay. Resolution.
Yeah. All right. Well, welcome. Come on up, John and Ted. Now, you know, John, I don't know if you're bringing in an asset here or liability based on Ted's previous steer here at the ADA.
We consider him a big asset.
Actually, I know, Chair, the reason you did lunch was that you knew I was going to be speaking, so you remember those days of me going on, so we'll be very brief.
Well, welcome. So, for those of us on the board that don't know all the background, John, I'll look to you to kind of fill Julie and Albert and Greg and Bernie in on it.
So State of Alaska has invested, under a previous administration, quite a bit of work on what they called a road to resources, which gets us across the Little Sioux and the Susitna River. Approximately one-third of the borough lies on the other side of the Susitna River. And unless you have a snow machine in the winter and it freezes up, or you have a plane, that is not open really to anyone in access. There are tremendous resources identified over there, and that is the main reason for this. We have had just a long-term plan to try to get across the Little Sioux, and then once that is done, the Big Sioux. In fact, we have taken some, not taxpayer dollars, but we've taken earnings from our community development program and the assembly on, I think it was Tuesday, October the 15th, set aside $1.5 million to get across the Little Sioux. So the assembly is in saying we are putting money aside to look for partners to really kind of start this project because we think it holds so much potential for the economics and what is really good for our communities. This project, you know, based upon our discussion with some local interest that has money behind it and willing to spend some money, is really it says a lot to them and their investors that if ADA and the Matsu Borough are willing not only to support this but put a little money behind this, it means a whole lot more than an actual money being involved, other than we're making that first commitment. And the value to the Matsu Borough is the LIDAR that's going to be flown, the digital work, the reconnaissance on the ground will have value. And we're doing it in a way where it is, once it is acquired, it will be available for public for anyone to use that. And more this, the ground truthing and digital data is having some extreme value for these type of projects. So we are very excited about it. We probably spent maybe a month and a half talking with your team forward.
So, Tom, just for the board's edification here, remind them that where the money comes from for the project, pre-development projects, that, you know, that we do have authorization and regulation and whatnot, that we have a fund, that we typically do this for projects.
We call these our 172 funds.
Yeah.
This is
it's not some oddball thing that we're taking, you know, plucking money out of the sky and just
no, and nothing is more central to the direction ADA has in statute than projects exactly like this.
I want to make sure the board and we get that on the record. So,
do we have money in that particular 172 fund for this project?
Yes, we certainly do.
Excellent. Okay. Sorry, John, but I want to make sure that was on the record, so thank you.
That's not a problem. So that's the gist of it. This is the first part, we think, of a tremendous opportunity. Of course, we would like these projects to come to Port McKenzie. We have available port there. We have, in fact, our port is 14 square miles. We have a deep water port that's available. It's 65 feet at low mean tide. You can get in, get out. In fact, we've had the largest Panamax ships come up for test runs. We loaded it with coal, I think, probably about 9 years ago and got it in and out. So there is opportunity. It's a resource that has been invested by the federal government and the state of Alaska and gotten us where we are. However, with any project, even if it doesn't go to Port McKenzie, we're supportive of that. We see the need to really kind of unlock our resources and provide other type of economy outside of the oil we're so dependent on. So this is strictly not a project that we have to have it our way. We want action and activity to happen and occur.
What kind of resources do you have there?
There has been timber, hard rock resources. There is coal. In fact, I think the state has some leases already through there. There's some we believe copper in the area, but because it's not had easy access before, a lot of these things have been noted and generally looked at. And so we think once that's happened in a transportation is available, this stuff will happen. And I think that's our biggest problem that we see is we have the resources, but the transportation costs to get it to market is not there or it's not cost effective. And I think once we can unlock that, we can be a world player. And I really think it will rival, you know, what we're doing with oil.
So the borough owns land on both sides of the river?
Yeah, yes, we do. Yes, we do. But the majority of it's state property, state and some federal.
John, I know it's...
Borough's on the west side of the Susitna.
John, I know it's just in the talking stages in the beginning. But Dan Sullivan, Senator Sullivan, has brought up the fact that he'd like to maybe get a naval base or a Marine Corps base, and they may want some access to that area as well?
Yes. So this is the Marine Corps, and we have invited them for their first step to do some training at Port McKenzie and this area. They need both land and water, which is available, and we're working with them to see if this is an opportunity. Our first couple meetings, it seems very promising to do so. We'd eventually, because we don't have one, is we think it'd be ideal to have a Marine base in this area to kind of mirror what the Army and Navy is doing, or Air Force is doing over at J-Bear.
Is there any northern route you guys are looking at?
I have not been involved in those discussions between the private party and ADA. I just want, I think...
I've heard the Petersville. You know, which already has a bridge across the Susitna,
yes,
north, but it doesn't have it across the Yetna.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't, from my understanding, that was under discussion. But our view is for us to do this initial investment, we are concerned about at least one of those routes, whether it's two or three or four, one of them leads to Port McKenzie, and that's pretty much what we said. You and the private entities are doing this. We don't care what you do as long as Port McKenzie is one of the routes that you examine.
Yeah, I thought there was. We're going to look at more than one route. I mean, is that true, Tom?
There are three routes that are being looked at.
Okay, so that's part of it because it's not here.
This is not all of it. These are two of the routes, which we define as the south route, which goes to Ladd Landing. Then there's the Port McKenzie route.
His name's Alan, by the way.
Alan Weiser with Eagle. And then once you pass the Susitna, there's another one that we call the east-west route, which goes fairly much straight across the Big Lake. Those are the three indicative routes at this point in time.
So I just want to make sure that there's...
Alan, and was there a northern route that was being discussed?
If we're going to talk with Alan, he has to come up on the microphone.
Well,
otherwise, Carson will get mad at me.
In the discussions with preliminary discussions and what John Moose had referred to about the month and a half, as we've been reviewing some of the indicative routes, the discussion with HDR, who is our principal consultant in defining some of these routes, along with Matsuburo, ourselves, and the private parties, we looked at a north route. It was not feasible. And in deference to what we have defined as the east-west route, which, Mr. Chair, the picture that you have right in front there is a attempt at an indication of what that east-west route would look at, but it's not a fully defined route. That's what we're looking for, the information on the study that we're interacting together to define.
Okay. Initial stages this fall, we have a certain scope that realistically can be done before snow.
Before snow, you're too late.
There's no snow up there right now. I just flew in yesterday. But you better hurry and get on it.
I think we brought in some wind to blow it all away.
All right, well, I just wanted to make sure that the one north route was at least considered, because you're halfway there already, and you have a bridge across the Susitna. You don't have one across the Yetna River. And it's just further north, and it has to tie into the parks, which really doesn't help your port. I mean, eventually it helps your port if it comes to it, but it's not direct, and it's not as conducive to what I call development of what I call a more urban area.
Like I was telling you, just before that teleconference we had, I had driven that route, and it's very, very, very challenging.
Yeah, but it's a right-of-way, and it's there. I mean, there's so question. I don't know if it's appropriate time for that. Do you anticipate that the access road, unlike Ambler or Red Dog, would be open to the public?
Yes, we do, to a point. Now, depending on an operation of a potential user, they may, for safety reasons or that sort of thing, may limit through their lease. But I appreciate you bringing up, Mr. Chair. We think that's very, very big for the Mattsu Borough residents to be able to have access over there for hunting, fishing, you know, other opportunities. The Mattsu Borough has quite a bit of land over there that we certainly would be available for homesteading and purchasing cabins and that sort of thing, and really enjoy, you know, what is really attractive about the valley is all these recreation opportunities.
Yeah. So it's, to me, it sounds like there's probably no issue on public access to the river. And then once you get across the river, it depends on the development and what's going on there. There's no question that between Port McKenzie and the river that you wouldn't limit public access.
Correct. And also, too, the majority of the property, I believe, is state property. So, that's going to be a state's issue as far as how they deal with whomever is using that.
What I can confirm in the preliminary discussions that we've had is exactly that case of different components that are being public versus resource use. And the access corridors that were defined to the Little Susitna were always viewed as public access.
Yeah, I would find it difficult to support something that didn't have public access. I just think that's a non-starter. Which really means you have to, the road, the facility has to be upgraded to public standards, which is, you know, a cost driver.
How many acres are we looking at over there that the borough owns?
I'm sorry, I didn't count them up. Quite a bit. Between the Little Susitna and the Susitna, we have quite a bit of property. I would say, just ballparking, we probably have about 10 to 15 square miles over there between.
Oh, this is serious property.
Yeah, yes.
It's your it's your property with no access.
That is correct. One third of the borough has no access.
You should have had access 50 years ago.
I agree with you.
I think we all know.
Yeah.
Julie?
So this initial funding is going to be to primarily defy the LIDAR and determine best route, right? After that, there will be more opportunities for the board to come and talk about what we do next, correct?
Correct. Absolutely correct. The way that we've agreed to do this is that each and every phase, we will have a new discussion with amongst our parties, again, entering into an MOU at this point in time between ADA
and the Matsu Borough. We'll have contribution agreements with underlying private parties that are the resource owners further out west. And it will be a discussion every point in time going forward what the budget is and the participants at that point and defining it exactly what we'll be doing. The total cost right now at what we budgeted at $200,000, we have defined costs within that and really expect to have a budget of about $140,000 underneath that. So we don't look at fully utilizing those funds, and then it'll be a discussion of how do we continue with the remaining funds and future funds for the next phase.
Well, I'm with Bernie. I think it's high time that we actually study how we can not just study.
I like a road.
Study,
I don't care where it
really
goes.
Like
somewhere.
To get a road.
I'm really not big on any more studies. I mean, let's build the road.
Yeah.
You got a RS-2477 or a trail or something over there, right? Right away.
But this is the first
step. Yes, sir.
Let's build her.
Yeah. So I would say that first I would congratulate you that you have someone paying half of it. But at the end of the day, I appreciate the borough driving it, and I look for my personal opinion is I think it is just supported. And regardless of the ultimate user's outcomes, I think you know you've got some challenges. I mean it's pretty finite what you can get to the river. It'd be a pretty expensive bridge to get across that river, but at some point something's got to happen. Right? If we can put a bridge across the Tanana River in Fairbanks for the military to a testing area, we sure as hell can go across the Susitna to millions of acres that are unavailable to the public. So, all right. I want to hear from Ted. Ted, you didn't come this whole way, Ted, without talking.
John doesn't let me talk.
No, so we get to hear from Ted.
Well, again, Chair, I really thank Ada and Tom and Alan and their staff for looking at this project. I mean, it's the start again of what Ada does, promoting economic development in the area. As John says, when you say a third of the borough, we're talking around 8,000 square miles of property or area that could be for development, for jobs, for the Matsu, for a diversified tax base. And it would be huge for the borough as we move forward. Again, we're discussing what Ada does. It's bringing together public-private partnerships with resource developers, being able to bring DNR in and them assisting in the LIDAR and those areas. And again, the Matsu Borough, the Assembly, and the citizens appreciate everything Ada's done throughout before. I mean, if you look at the revolving loan fund, there's a large portion of that fund. Not look at Chris, but anyway, in assisting businesses in Matsu Borough. And again, this first step in opening up this land is really, we're really appreciative of the work Ada's done in helping us move forward.
Ted, which entity is the lead on this? Is it the borough? Is it Ada? Is it the second party, a third party? Who's actually taking the lead on this? Who's the go-to organization?
It is Ada, and we can have Alan. We have input to that. We have already deposited our $50,000 with Ada.
That is correct, isn't it?
Okay. Yeah, I didn't bring it,
we are the lead organization. Is that correct?
Well, to the extent that we have this resolution and the MOU, which is part of your packet, and we got the people here, we could sign the MOU, then certainly that's in the affirmative. If we get down the road to where we need an EIS or something less than that, then it'd be much more appropriate and would be the plan to have the borough be the lead in going ahead with an EIS in the same fashion that Ada is involved in the EIS in Ambler. So, but that's a ways down the road, and then frankly,
I'm looking for someone asked me, what about this road access road, the resources of the you know, to the borough, who do I direct them to? Do I direct them to the Mattu? Do I direct them to Allen? Do I direct them to who?
Kirsten.
I would suggest that you, under the terms of our MOU, where it defines our roles, the lead party is the Mattu borough, and John Moosey is the right principal contact okay. for that kind of direction.
Sorry, John.
No, I'm happy to do so, okay. But the agreement, as far as the work being done, is being done through ADA on this MOU.
Again, I'm talking about, you know, from a again, someone says, hey, tell me about this project. Who do I talk to? I have some property out there I may want to develop or whatever, an opportunity. I just want to be able to say, focus, you know, talk to John and the Mattu or talk to Alan, whoever. There's one point of contact. There's not three.
That would be me, and you can also say that my assembly has designated $1.5 million for moving this project forward.
Okay.
So why wouldn't you just go ahead and just build the damn road? Just go ahead and do it. Just go ahead and get after it. Let's go ahead and put a dozer trail in and get her done, and then when you get down to the river. You guys are you're a municipality, so you can get a Bailey Bridge. I know where there's a couple of them setting. We'll put a Bailey Bridge across there, and even if we got to put a float in the middle, we'll just put a little float in the middle. We'll do a Bailey Bridge. We can have that done in 2 weekends. What I'm saying is, now you got access, and then we got some opportunity here. Then we'll worry about all the other stuff.
I think the board needs to go see your operations. Yeah,
he's always been known as the guy who's got the equipment.
Yeah. Oh, I know someone.
Anyway, I'm just saying. I love your.
We want
your
John to keep his job.
What are they going to do? Take the property away from them? They're the government. Oh, we're going to take all your property away. Good luck. We're going to take the river away.
Well, I think
come
some
on.
Some of the land they got to cross.
Why don't you just lead? I think you're a good leader.
Thank you, sir. That's river kind of you to say.
Get a little some wetlands. I don't know. You know.
They won't be wet when he fills them in.
As the chair said, and Alan said, we are the lead, but the role that ADA plays is that coordinating factor of bringing us along with their expertise, with DNR, with the private developers that are looking. That's critical for for the borough going forward in opening up these resources and having some type of base to know if we build that road or that corridor that we have these developers there to utilize it.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's you know, if no one knows about it, then you don't have an opportunity to say, hey, we may be a user too, which helps the project. And so I just want to make sure the people I visit with say, hey, here's who you want to talk to. It's theory. You're going out and do a study. You may want to understand what they're doing and talk about what the potential you could bring to the as far as the opportunity. And I just want to be able to say, go to John at the Mattu,
yeah.
and he's talked to you, and he'll then direct you to wherever you're supposed to go.
And Mr. Carl, I certainly understand your point.
He's like a borough resident.
I just don't want to get you bogged down in a bunch of minutiae where you don't get anything done. That's your property. They can't deny you access. Go for it.
But what we want to do is seek a private partner for a user. You know, as a borough manager, I'm very fearful on, ooh, let's charge ahead and tell the private business person or private entity what's best for them. We need to partner with them and follow the direction. When I got here 9 years ago, I was given this little boat to take care of because the Mattu borough knew better than everybody else on how to make this thing work. And when we looked at how it was going to be used for the user, it did not make any sense for us. So we want to move this ahead, but we need to know who our audience is, who our users are.
There's nothing free, Marty.
Well, no, I mean, they figured that out, didn't they?
Right. So it was a good lesson for the Mattu borough, and I am making sure we never repeat that. And we look to who is going to use it, who's going to pay for the use, and does it make financial sense? We certainly think this has a huge opportunity to do so from a variety of things, from business, from resource development, from personal use, and also, too, for hunting and fishing and opening up.
To me, it's real simple. No access, no opportunity.
Correct.
Access equals opportunity. So, you know, you can hope that you're going to find somebody to sign up and use it, but I'm going to tell you, if you have access, you will have opportunity. No access, no opportunity.
Albert?
So what's the time horizon on actually, like, breaking ground to build the road?
That is really going to be dependent, I think, on our private partners.
Well, let's say you find a private partner.
Probably with EIS and that sort of thing, we're probably maybe 3 years out. If we knew today they were going to invest and move forward, I'd say from what I know, we'd be a minimum of 3 years out before we're turning dirt.
The reason I bring that up is because we have an amazing opportunity with who's in the White House, who's in the governorship, that they're willing to do these types of deals. We could be sitting here in a couple of years looking at the people who want to close up Alaska as a park. So what can we do to speed things up to make this a reality instead of waiting and studying?
Well, through the chair to Director Fogel, I mean, this is the first key to being able to do that, going through. And this isn't a study. It's identifying corridors.
Right.
And without knowing what corridor that is going to be the best, we won't know where to
do that bulldozer, get across the bridge.
But the good news is a start.
Right.
So you can get some awfully good Google Maps for free. And I bet you could plot a course within, it'd be pretty doggone good within an hour. Well, so and we could still be.
What they're going to do is they're going to do that, and then they're going to use LIDAR to fly it and get the actuals. And they want to do that before the snow's on the ground to get actual elevation.
Wow.
So we need to do it now.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, what can ADA do besides approving this resolution to help speed up the process?
I think this is a great first step. We need to know where the road's going to be built and what are the challenges and what are the costs. One of the things that that we have is we have a love and it's almost sacred for our fish, salmon. And doing that correctly up front not only says, you know, can say, hey, you know, we are environmentally sensitive, but we're doing it in a way that really kind of promotes good business and good business opportunities. I don't know. I know we have a president in the White House who wants to go, and he's knocking away a lot of roadblocks, but there is still an awful lot that needs to be done. I mean, right now I'm told that a mine takes 8 to 10 years to open up. I mean, he waves away half those regulations. We're still probably 6 years into doing that. I mean, Donlin Gold, who we are, you know, personally cheerleaders for, hope we can move forward. I mean, that's a 25-year process. Let's say we cut that in half. I mean, that's still a decade. We are, I think, so entrenched by regulations from the feds that is also passed down to the state that make these things time suckers. And the concern is just moving forward on there that we get hauled in and have to do a project, or we take a misstep, and that's the reason we cannot move forward, because we did not follow the proper procedures and made a mistake, and the whole project goes kaput. We've had, from my understanding, a lot of projects out there in the public, I mean, we've done in the public, that just never seem to be able to get over the hurdle or get 90% complete and not done. And I mean, I'm sitting on one right now. We are 65% complete on a 32-mile rail line. I'm out of funds right now. And so if we had that rail, a 32-mile rail to Port McKenzie, our story would be a whole lot different. And there, I'm 100% positive there would be all kinds of activity happening in Port McKenzie right now and getting stuff out to the market. But directing the investment and sticking with that investment until the project's complete, I think, is very, very important. Our problem is it goes to two or three, administrations. Priorities change. Priorities change for me on my assembly. I have election every year, and we may be going great guns, and then we get change of at the election, and we're slowed down. or we need to take a second look, or this was not my priority, and so therefore we're taking our focus off what we're doing here and putting some up. So I would say, and that's a good question, Albert, it's if we can be consistent, if ADA is in, they are all in, moving forward, I think probably the best thing they can do, just be consistent and push forward on the projects that you decide are worthy of ADA.
Okay, so I'm going to speed everybody up. Let's hurry up and talk about this, and we've got to go into the Ambler one.
Okay,
we have a resolution in front of us.
I can follow up on that. I've been following this project for probably better than 20 years, and I've watched assemblies come and assemblies go, and this assembly is probably balanced. And for them to set aside $1.5 million makes quite a statement. I'm going to go out on a limb, and I think after the November election, it's even going to be even better as far as the assembly getting behind the thing. So the first step is to approve this. Believe me, once they know where they're going and what route it is, I have no doubt they'll find the end users in an expedited, because they've got plenty of support besides assembly. That the local business owners are in complete support of it. So they there won't be any feet dragging. They'll be getting it done. They'll be back here as quick as they can.
Thank you, Bill. All right. Thank you.
Now
we got Ambler.
Yeah, if you'd like backfilling on details on the dollars, I'll ask Mark Davis.
On the Ambler, you got $718,000. Where's that money coming from?
Okay, I'll ask Mark Davis to come up and.
Is this grant dollars from the state for the original Ambler, or is it coming out of our checking account?
No, you can call it the checking account. This is 172.
Why are we doing it so early? Before we get the record of decision?
There are two answers to that, and both are true. One, this is just authorization to keep going. We won't spend the money if it's
not
necessary.
I'm just playing devil. We don't know the route. We don't know what the rules of the game are going to be. And you want us to pass a resolution. Spending $718,000 is not going to get reversed.
No, I want authorization, and this isn't a spend. This is
budget allocations.
When would we spend it then?
And how do we know if this is what we want to spend it for based on what?
Well, I have Mark Davis here who originated the amounts and originated the resolution. Better for him to answer that. But I do want to point out this money won't necessarily be spent. This is our estimate of what we might need should the process go certain directions.
Okay, Mark, I guess we'll listen.
For the record, my name is Mark Davis, and thanks, Mr. Chair. So we've asked for several types of money. One is with regard to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, a compensatory mitigation plan. As part of the current EIS process, they've requested that, and they've expedited their permitting for the Clean Water Act part of the proposed project. Their comments on that also closed October 29th, and they've asked us to fund a mitigation plan, which is a common part of an EIS. So that's just part of the ongoing process. We've also got
they
money.
Ask us, they're asking ADA individually,
yes.
The organization, to fund it.
Yes.
Prior to any record of decision.
Yes.
And this isn't legislative approved dollars that we used for the Ambler process to begin with.
That's right.
$18 million?
That's right. It's about $17 million. And
we spent all that?
No, we haven't spent all that, but this, we need some additional funds to continue these additional activities, perhaps. That's why Tom said we don't necessarily spend this money, but we're seeking authorization so that we can keep going.
Well, I'm not against spending the money.
No, so as you get toward the end of an EIS process, which we're at, because the comments close October 29th, then the next step is going to be, and we've got some money in here, we're starting to get low on the funds, the appropriated funds. We think that we're going to get requests from the BLM to fill in extra data that has been generated by the public comments. For example, There's been concerns about subsistence. We've stated that we're willing to set up a subsistence committee, so we're asking for funds to actually start doing that, to demonstrate to the public that we're sincere about that. Also, they're going to ask for, I think, some culture activity reports based on the public comments. So when you have a draft EIS, then the agency is going to go back to the proponent, which is us, and say, we need some more data. That's just part of the process. And we want to be able to respond. That's kind of what these funds are for, except for the Corps of Engineers. The Corps of Engineers are on a separate track under the Clean Water Act, and they've expedited their process, and they're asking us to keep going. I think that's actually good news. That means the Corps is getting ready to develop a 404 permit so that we would be able to put gravel, you know, where you need to build the road.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, again, half the things you said, Mark, is that you think they're going to ask for this stuff, and so you want us to authorize money to be spent without really knowing what they want.
We've
three or four times, I think this is what they're going to ask for. Right?
Well, we know they've asked for a compensatory mitigation plan. We've already gotten a communication from the Corps, and what I asked Dal to do as our project manager, I said, what do you expect that to cost? You know, and so we put together a budget based on the communicate. We got a letter from the Corps of Engineers, and they want us to prepare this report.
Question?
Go ahead.
So this is most of this budget is in anticipation of what's going to show up in the public comments period at the end of the month, correct?
A lot of it is, yes, ma'am.
And then we'll have a certain amount of time to respond to those public comments. So question is, is it worthwhile to wait until the next board meeting when we know exactly what those public comments are, or will we be short on time by that time to be able to respond?
To the chair, we could be later pressed on time because we don't know what the time frame we will get from the BLM is. The BLM would like to issue, if it can, the record of decision, which is the final process of this, in early 2020. And there's been a request to the BLM, for example, to extend the public comment period beyond October 29th, and the BLM has declined to do that. So it looks as if they are set to issue their record decision in early 2020, which means that we'll be spending this money in December.
Do you have a full budget you can give us, Mark? This is $700,000 of how much more?
This will take us through the permitting for the 404 process, the 106 process, which is archaeological.
How much more do we have to spend to be able to before we be able to go out for design and construction?
This is the budget that would get you to the rod. After that, we can go for design and construct.
Okay, and that means you'll have an agreement in place with the end users.
Before we go to design and construct, then after we get the rod, our next step is to go to the mining companies and say, now we have a route, now we have a record of decision, now we have a 404 permit.
So do you have the route? Do you have agreement on the route from landowners? Is that all tied together?
No. And our next step is to go out to the landowners and seek a route.
After you get.
But remember, we have three right now. So we have to have a rod before we can actually go out and negotiate.
So is there any common, of the three routes, are they all the same landowners?
They're all Doyon, Department of Natural Resources, and NANA are the primary. There's a few others, but those are the primary three.
So do you have agreement from Doyon and whatnot on the routes?
We do not have an agreement with Doyon. We have to have discussions.
Let me add too. This is a reality of one, an EIS, and two, a state agency being the proponent, because BLM needed somebody to pay for it, and of course it takes a federal agency to do an EIS. But I also want to point out there's a step in here that we haven't discussed, which is quite likely, and that is litigation.
And who pays for that?
We happen to have attorneys right here in the room.
Is Ada pay for that?
Under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, if a suit is brought, it would be brought against the lead federal agency, which is the Bureau of Land Management, and they will defend themselves to the U.S. Department of Justice.
Okay.
So they won't bring the state into that lawsuit?
They usually, that does not happen.
And so we don't have to appropriate money for attorneys to monitor what's going on?
I'm fully capable of monitoring a lawsuit like that. The former member of the U.S. Department of Justice Environmental Enforcement Section.
So I guess my concern is it's almost the cart before the horse in my view, because when you said they may ask for this, we think they're going to ask for that, and you've got a dollar amount based on what a may, instead of saying, does that make sense? They may ask for this, and here's our budget, but it may be something similar in the budget. This may be apples and oranges. I have a hard time connecting those dots.
Let me go through it with each other. Some of them are harder than others. For example, the last one on the list, which is the Cultural Resources Management Plan, or the CRMP, that actually has to be done as part of NEPA. Yeah. And we've got a contractor, and that's a hard dollar. They bid $150, and we've gone down. We negotiated, we got them down to $125. So that's actually a hard bid. We know what the Corps wants in their management, in their plan. And I've asked Dow to give us the best figure they can. So I think the $150 is pretty solid if Dow's doing their work right. We also know that the anti-degradation report for DEC, which is a water quality report, we asked DNR what that would cost, and we received this figure of $40,000. So that's another hard figure. The additional travel expenses are based upon BLM stating that they would need $6,000 more for three flights, so $18,000.
Is the money that the state appropriated for this gone? Is it done? So why you can't use that money?
But we're going to run out of money.
But where's the balance? And I guess I understand the $700 ask, but I don't see what we spent to date and what we expect to pay in the future. It's just like, let's just approve this without knowing both sides of the other sides, and I have a problem with that. Okay. Public money. I love the project, but I'm just wondering. It's like I don't know the whole extent, and I don't really know what I'm approving on the overall picture.
Well, what we're asking for, we're almost out of the appropriated money.
Well, what's almost?
Yeah.
Let's see. If I got Julie.
This is Brenda Applegate. We have approximately, I think, $39,000 that's uncommitted and unencumbered.
I thought it was $64,000, and I didn't want to miss it.
Out of how many million?
$32,000.
Out of how many million?
We started out with $17 million in state appropriations.
And we don't have an EIS for $17
million?
Excuse me. We don't have an EIS, and we've spent $17 million?
That's correct. Half of that money was spent by another agency, and we took over the project, and then we've spent about less than half of that in 6 years versus the other agency spending that much money and less time. And I don't want to criticize the other agency.
The state agency?
DOT?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So ADA hasn't spent that all that, but we had to when we took over the project, we had to finish the contracts that had been let by DOT. That was, you know, they were already there. We had to finish them.
Again, I go back to the ask is not really definite, and it's based on what you think. And I guess. That's my challenge, is that you think they're going to ask for this, so we think it's going to cost this much money. That just doesn't seem right to me.
And I have talked to Mark and Tom about some of this. So my understanding is, based on traditional EIS, is some of this stuff would have normally been included up front in the EIS planning, and it wasn't. So there was a miss there in the previous process. And so this stuff will have to get done one way or the other. My concern, and why I would be supportive of this once we figure out the dollars, is that we have to be ready to act and act in a very timely manner. And we can't wait till the December 4th board meeting to do that, is my understanding. So if we could have a better understanding of where the money's coming from, how we're going to recoup those costs if we put another $700,000+ into it. Do we get that back at any point in time when it actually becomes a project?
The finance plan for this would be to roll the cost of the permitting which will go beyond this. There's other funding besides the EIS. Is to roll that into the cost of the project, and then ADA gets paid back. The state gets paid back, and ADA gets paid back. That's the model. That's how Red Dog worked, and that's
There's got to be an economic viability. The people have got to sign up. You've got to have the right-of-way agreements in place. I mean, that's a lot of stuff down the stream. So in my mind, this money may, or well, I would say right now, based on today, that since you don't even have the landowners locked in to whatever route it is or an agreement, it's 50-50 at best.
Well, there's always project risk with permitting. That is, you can get you can even obtain an EIS and not have a project. That's something I've explained to the legislature when I've testified previously. But without an EIS, you can't enter into the agreements with the potential users of the road.
Right.
So the problem becomes for economic development. You know, what entity is going to pay for the risk of that permitting risk? You know, and what entity can recoup its costs. And so when you talk about money being spent in this way, we used some of the 172 monies back in 2013 to analyze whether ADA should take this project over from DOT. Did it make any sense? DOT had spent a fair amount of money.
Does it make sense to break this resolution out to an A and B? A being the Cook Inlet access, and the B being Amber. Board, what do you think?
Well, I'm supportive of both of them.
Yeah. I'm supportive of both of them also.
Well, I'll tell you, I guess this is where the rubber hits the road, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you wonder if it isn't throwing good money after bad when you don't even know what you're throwing it at. And $17 million's already been spent with a minimal amount of things being done because we don't have an EIS. Or even close, actually. So, but then you come to the other side. If you're going to do any development, you got to go through these steps. And if there was a misfire and DOT didn't quite do it the way they should have, well, are we going to penalize the state for that? I'd say we can't really do that. So I'm going to have to hold my nose if I have to vote for this today, but I guess that's what I'm going to have to do.
Well, I guess I don't understand why you need the subsistence committee right away without the record. I mean, just there's a few things on this thing that just seems odd to me. But Tom, you wanted to talk.
Yeah, thanks very much. And first, the question you just asked. You know, a subsistence committee is a big part of one or more of these landowners coming on board. And certainly, what the board does today is something that they're paying attention to. But that's not the question. This is very far out on the risk spectrum, and for ADA. Way at the other end is our loan participation program, where we really have no OREOs or anything. And Julie, Sandy, and Alan and I were talking to some bankers. I guess a week ago Friday, they talked about the high quality of our loans, our loans and our loan participation program, and you know it might have looked to them like we were out there high grading and taking the best loans throughout Alaska, and I brought up Ambler and I said, well, that's private equity kind of risk way out there, but who would do? And they were familiar with Ambler. And I said, who else would do that but ADA? Who else would take that private equity kind of risk? And it really is, and it depends on some things. It depends on certainly.
I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
And I agree with the risk. And I don't mind taking the risk, but I don't know how much more risk we're going to have to throw out before we know what we have a project. That's the part. This is $700,000 of what? How much more? I don't know how much more before that you're anticipating on a budgetary. Is it another 700? Is it 50,000? Is it 5 million? How many more dollars are you going to come back to ADA to the board and ask for this high risk project? It's not that we don't support the project. It's just we don't have a clue, at least I don't, on what you think the ask is, the total ask. This is one part of it.
Yeah, we're just about at the finish line on the EIS.
But there's more to it than that. You're talking about the EIS. What else before we actually, how many more dollars do we have to spend in your estimation, because you guys have been following the project and doing, how many more dollars we have to spend, do you think it comes out of the ADA revolving fund, not the state, unless we get a grant, right?
How
many more dollars before is anticipate before we actually have a no, yes or no on the project?
I have an answer to that, and I've talked to the Alaska miners and any number of groups, and I'll give them the same kind of review that I give you, the same kind of review I give them. We're just about at the finish line on the EIS, and we're anticipating a record of decision and the alternative that we prefer. We might have a period of litigation, as we talked about a minute ago. If we are successful through that, and if we're still in 2020 at that time, and somebody who opposes this hasn't pushed us into a different White House, then the next spend is going to be some combination, I think, of ADA GO bonds and ADA cash. And it'll be north of $25 million, and it won't be in excess of $50 million. And when we're in that stage, we'll have firm commitments to go revenue bonds to get to the first mine, and that'll be part of that process. So
your agreement will be in place. So I'm trying to find out what's your budget before an agreement's in place. How many dollars? This is 700 of how much?
So if we do obtain a record decision from the BLM and a route that is feasible, then the next steps are to look at other permits that are needed, and then also negotiate for potential rights of way with other landowners and other with the mines for commitments. Those will largely be negotiations that would entail legal fees by third-party counsel if we come to an agreement.
Well, you're not free, Mark, so there's a budget for you.
No. So our budget. So the infrastructure. I was trying to get there. Our infrastructure division.
All the different steps is great. Velocity, look, how many dollars?
Yeah, I would think. We're going to push. $800,000 in additional legal fees and negotiations, and the budget of the infrastructure division.
On top of the 718.
Yes. That's if we have a record decision. That's to try to get MOUs in place, for the mines to commit.
So maybe
the landowners
total to get to where you have an agreement.
Wait a sec. Hold on, Mr. Chair. If we're able to anticipate what is about to come out and we need this extra 718, then you should be able to give us a rough estimate of what we're going to be needed to get to the construction phase of ADA's dollars. So why don't we have a budget in place already for that?
So for the record, my name is Jeff San Juan. I'm the project manager working with Mark on the AMBA project. And I want to answer a lot of these different questions that the chair has. And then, so through the chair, you asked about how much money has been spent to date. So from the inception of the project, $26.2 million, $26,200,000 has been spent. That's been appropriated by the legislature. The last appropriation was in 2015. So there has not been any new appropriation for this project since 2015. The 9.2 went to DOT, and then when they went out to the when DOT went out and did what the Matsu Borough is trying to do with this project, look at different routes, they heard from the community members that none of the community members wanted a public road. And so that's when it was transferred over to ADA in 2012-2013. So from that point in time is when ADA got some of the money from DOT, but we also got an appropriation in 2014 and 2015 of $8.5 million and $8.5 million, which equals the $17 million that you're talking about. So up until, I think as Brenda mentioned, we have about $32,000 remaining in that appropriation. So we're pretty much at the end, and Tom was saying you're pretty much out of funds. And when you're going through the EIS process, the AMDA project is different than your regular EIS project.
I'm going to stop. We got time constraints.
Sure.
What you just said is
We're $1.5 million short. According to what? We're $1.5 million short, right?
Yes.
It is what it is.
To get to a lot. Here,
it's $1.5 million short. So the original budget or whatever people put together, whatever stage she originally did it, and now Ada, we're $1.5 million short.
Yes.
What I really care about is it $1.5 million? The 700 is part of that. Is it $1.5 million? Because we're going to hold you to it.
Right. I think $1.5 million will get us to a lot.
We're going to hold you to that because, I mean, you're the professional. You guys are doing the project. You've been doing it since 2013, is that what
yes.
you're saying? So for the board, satisfaction, right? Is it $1.5 million? That's what I don't want to see come in here personally as an individual board member is that there's another $2 million ask. Oh, by the way, we've got this and we've got that. We got that up front. What is it? This is 700 of a $1.5 million ask, and I think that's a
yes,
fair question.
That's fair.
Correct?
Yeah, I want to
see what's the rest. Show us the rest. Put it on
paper.
If
you'd given this money to the Mattsu Borough, they would have that place all developed over there, and they'd have some
that's
stuff.
Right.
Bridges
that's right.
built and things happening.
That's right.
I'm telling you.
That's right. You know, I'm a little taken back a little bit by we think they're going to ask for this, and so we need the money for that. Okay. I'm not privy to how all that stuff kind of works, and I'm wondering if we get a lawsuit. The subsistence committee, how much a year that's going to cost us, why the lawsuits yeah. are being fought, you know, all that kind of stuff. Maybe it's $100,000 a year. I don't know about that.
Right.
I just want the number. I want the number yeah. so I can monitor and gauge what we're doing and if we're getting what we're paying for and you guys are following the budget.
Right.
Okay? That's what's important.
Also, Mr. Chair, I'd like to see maybe on our follow-up board meetings a placeholder for an AMBER update so that we can see where the costs are going. And if we're on target.
Because now it's out of our checkbook.
Right, correct.
Greg?
Yeah. So back to your original idea, can we break the resolution into two? So I would be willing to do that. The second question on these expenditures, if there's things that are required today that have been asked for and we have no choice, then we could vote for those. And then the things that haven't been asked for today, let's take those off the table. We could certainly have a board poll at some point that I'd be willing to support. If they asked us 2 weeks from now, we don't want to wait till December. And maybe that would satisfy some of the chairman's concerns as a possible compromise here.
I kind of agree with most of what you just said. And I think in the future we should do that. You know, they're two completely different programs and that they should have standalone together where they've kind of combined these two. You know, one's 50,000 and one's 700,000 of something that we think it's $1.5 million. And there are things on this. I have to take staff at you know, their professionals are the word that we need this stuff. I'm just concerned about we think this is what they're going to ask, and so here's the number against something we think. I just have a hard time connecting that. It's hard for me.
I mean, I agree. You hate to sign in approving this, then we're kind of signing a blank check that we're going to approve the next thing and the next thing without knowing what it is. And
yeah.
Again, if the staff thinks that all this is absolutely essential today that it's been asked for, then I'm going to vote for it because I want to keep the project moving. But if it's just things we think versus some things we know,
yeah.
I'd also be willing, if it satisfies everybody, to break them up.
Okay.
But I think it was made clear that you're giving us your estimate of another $800,000, and you know that we're going to hold you to that because that's what the chairman said here. So I feel a lot better. At least we got that number out of them. So I feel a lot better. I feel a lot better.
They're
that
cheap.
They're not cheap. I can tell you that. I would rather give that to Mattsu too. I'd rather just give them. I'd just rather give you their $50,000 and give them the $718,000. I think we'll get a lot more done.
We need to find a place for you to live in a valley.
No, I'm just saying. You know.
I mean, in fairness, they can't guarantee the $800,000.
No, I'm afraid we are.
That's right.
In order to respond to you and worried about the clock, we're giving you the impression that there's a level of precision here available that's not available to anybody. We had no choice but to have the federal government run an EIS. Okay, we had no choice but to hire consultants that can look you in the eye and give you an invoice for $100,000 with no trouble. Hiring a consultant to do something costs 2 to 3 times what it costs to have somebody in this who works in this building do the same job. But we can't staff up for this. You know, we couldn't staff, and I just got here really relative to this EIS. and you know, but you can't staff up for this EIS. But I'm worried that you're demanding a level of precision, and we're looking at the clock, and we're saying, well, we want to pass this resolution. This level of precision, when you've got trustees for Alaska going to sue us, you know, or and maybe others. And when I say us, sure, the defendant is going to be the federal government because that's the way the process is. But we've got more of an interest in the outcome of this than anybody in the federal government. And we could have a President Warren who has a Secretary of the Interior who has a keen interest in making sure crossing a national park with a new road in Alaska never happens, you know. And so don't let us mislead you by trying to make you happy that there's some level of precision here that's available, because there isn't a level of precision whatsoever, and yet no one but ADA can really do this on behalf of Alaskans.
Let me make a couple comments there. I don't disagree, Tom. The problem I think most of us are having, maybe just me, is that there's no budget. We're trying to get a number out of you. What do you think, based on your expertise and your historical knowledge, what it's going to take to get us a finish line? That's prudent business. Business 101, right? I mean, we have the right to ask that.
Yeah.
And you, as stewards of the state funds and this organization, professionally should have that in your hip pocket. And I will say that. That if you don't, there's a problem.
We have staff that's been working on it for years.
So we asked for what the total spend is, of which $700,000. If it's $800 or $900 or $300, it's a number. But it's something that we as a board then can use, say, well, this is part of the original conceptual budget. We don't have that. So we board, unfortunately, is flying in the blind. And I don't think that's correct. I think you should reorganize your group and say, we're not letting the board fly in the blind anymore, and we're certainly not going to put $700,000 in front of them without knowing what the total spend is. That's ridiculous. I've never heard of such a thing, quite frankly. That being said, that's not the level of precision. It's your best estimate of what it's going to take based on your experience, because you just said, we think this is what they're going to ask, and this is what we think it's going to cost. Those numbers came from somebody that has some experience doing something.
Yeah.
Right?
And go through the menu here.
But there's more to the story. We want the whole story, and we want to understand everything that you think is going to come down and the rationale and the risk according to each bullet point, right? We have no clue.
Right.
I do know that we also have a choice as a board to say no and throw it back to the state and say appropriate some more money, or you're not going to have an AMBAR access road. It doesn't have to come out of ADA's revolving fund. We could force them back to the legislature and say, good luck.
Mm-hmm.
We spent the money. Here's where we're at. We got $700,000 into it to get to a record decision. It's up to you. Do you want another, you know, but you got to give them a number. I mean, we get to make that choice. So that's what's important. We want to help you, but we can't help you unless we know the big picture.
Mm-hmm. And I would recommend, through the chair, Jeff San Juan, I would recommend that I think we have a lot of the answers for the board to, in budget-wise and economics that you're looking for. So I think maybe if you would like a special session, because I think the AMBAR project is a fairly large project that you can't really get done in a regular board meeting. So we would open up, or if you want a special subcommittee on the board to actually dive into this project, be more than happy to go into a lot of the details that you're asking, because we do have answers for you, Mr. Chair.
It's not really details, Jeff. It's just give us a number and what makes up that number by bullet points, and then track it and tell us what's going on. It's going to ebb and flow, but we have something to go on. I can't go on the street and tell you how much ADA is going to have to spend to get to the finish line to get an agreement with the end users. I can't tell anybody that. I should be able to say something. You know, we're budgeting $1.5 million now. Maybe it's $2 million. Maybe it's $5 million. Whatever the number is, I think it's important that we understand that and we work with you to get to the finish line. We're all supportive of the project. We're not supportive of not knowing, blindly going down the road and not even knowing what road we're on. And that's kind of what I feel on this, with this ask. So this is good to be able to go through this and bring up these concerns, because, you know, If which I guarantee you, Tom, there's going to be lawsuits. Absolutely guarantee you, right? Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Get with Jerry and you guys figure out what aid is paying and how long it's going to take. And by the way, if we've got a subsistence committee and all that, you got to put in how long does it keep that active while we're waiting for the lawsuits. You know, whatever we have to put on warm storage while we wait for the lawsuits, that there's an economic consequence to that. And I don't think that $800,000 is going to cover that.
No, what I've been saying in public is it's going to take us $25 to $50 million to get to the stage where we can sell revenue bonds backed up by tolls. That's what I've been telling the miners. That's what I've been. That's what I've told the governor. And that's what I've told any number of people. 25 to 50 million from today will get a. And I don't think anybody can have any more precision than that. I don't think anybody can even forecast the legal actions that anybody is going to take against this project to try to get it into the next White House. And that duration will have a lot to do with the cost. So I've been telling people 25 to 50 million will get us to where we can sell revenue bonds backed up by tolls for the first project.
Julie?
So I would like to request that I understand the time sensitivity to these dollars, and I'm sympathetic, but I do support the project. But I would ask that at our next board meeting that you come to us with a fully detailed budget where we started, and we're talking, you know, high. Just line items, not the detail of everything, but just a very high-level budget and shows us where we spent, what we have left to spend it on, why we have it left to spend on, where the dollars are going to come from, and so that we can talk to that every time we have a board meeting and say, what's changed? I think a $25 to $50 million, that's a huge spread to say and as an estimate. We should have some level of detail to support that kind of claim.
Yes. Greg, I agree.
So this is the first time I've heard that we're going to have to spend $25 to $50 million, and I have no idea why. And I'm a board member, no one's told me that. So
I think that's, that you're 1 of 7 here.
Well, okay, so we should have a detailed, why are we going to spend $25 to $50 million over the next couple of years?
If we obtain a ROD, then the next step under our statutes is to present the board with a finance plan, and because we have to sanction this, it's a 172 project. And until we get a ROD, there's no reason to do that.
You don't know how much it is until you know what the ROD is.
No, that's right.
That's why I'm focused on what it takes us to get us to a ROD.
No, but
that's to me is the short term. Long term, I believe, you know, with Greg. You know, whether it's 25 or 50 or 15 or 150, those numbers are what they are based on you guys working through with consultants to come out based on the route. And that's a separate financing. This is just cash out of the revolving fund. And I'm trying to figure out what the economic ask is going to be to get to that point. That's all.
It can also be no action. That's an alternative in the ROD. That's end of story if that's what it comes out.
Well, I think if it's a $50 million deal, I mean, we got to go to the legislature for approval anyway.
Revenue bonds? We think revenue bonds work here, and they work better.
Yeah, but we still have to ask the legislature.
I understand.
They have to approve it, don't they?
Well, the answer to your question is yes, but let me clarify, too. That $25 to $50 million, I've been telling people, is some combination of ADA GO bonds, that is the general obligation of ADA, and cash. And nobody has refined it. It's too early. The no action alternative, if that should be chosen, or if environmentalists find a way to delay this until the Elizabeth Warren White House, then there will be a no action alternative. And we're done.
It's like it's making me nervous. You must know something.
Well, so if you go back to the steps. Well, if we get a ROD, then we were going to enter negotiations, and I gave you what I thought would be the legal fees for those negotiations, and then we would need to present you with a finance plan under 173 for a 172 project. And the development of that finance plan, which the board, I guess not all the board members have seen a finance plan because they haven't done a big project for a while, but that's required under our statute.
Yeah, and that's fine, and that's a whole separate, to me that's a whole separate topic.
But it's a bullet point that, okay, after we spend $1.5 million, the next thing we're going to deal with is this, right? Provided, one, we get a permit, there's no legal action stuff. Maybe you put a bullet point in there for some legal stuff and warm storage. I call it warm storage, right? You know, keeping your outreach going and you know, the subsistence community, whatever that is. That's what I'm looking for, okay?
We don't need piecemeal information.
We
want you to lay out the whole plan so we can see it and know what's coming up step by step until the day we have trucks rolling down the road and bringing ore down to McKenzie.
So the finance plan would be that detail, you know, and we haven't looked at that because if Route C is chosen, it's much, much different than Route A or B.
Then you got three little branches on. We don't need the detail. We just need to see the picture.
Well, I think at the end of the day, the board is a little sensitive to just having $700 thrown at them based on a reaction that you think may happen.
Without
understanding the big picture and without having more detail as far as we think. Maybe it's the wrong term you used. We think they're going to ask for this, so we think this is what it's going to cost. We want you to approve this much money.
That was the only response to one issue. That is the issue of how much we may be asked for additional information based on the public comments by the Bureau of Land Management.
And I would also ask
that
we
can't anticipate. We're trying to anticipate what level we may need to respond to.
The resolutions are separate based on projects specific.
Okay.
All right. Julie, Sandy, are you still on? Do you have any questions?
No, I don't have any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Further discussions on the resolution. Anybody want to put it on the table?
I move resolution G19-21.
Second.
Discussion. Any further discussion? I think we put quite a bit on the record.
Yep.
Right. I think the ask is for the next, from the commissioner, the next board meeting, we have a little more detail on it. Okay.
Of the overall picture.
Of the overall picture. Plus, for me, what's important is shore up that $1.5 million, whether it's $1.6 million or $1.4 million, whatever the number is, based on, you know, I'm not going to hold you to the penny, but based on what you think to get us through the record of decision. And then secondly, have what I would call a warm storage price on an annual basis if there's legal ramifications. And then obviously third, you know, just be a bullet point, you know, your 172 finance plan. That doesn't have, you know, but you can't really tell us that until you know which route you're doing and all that kind of stuff. And I think actually by December you will have a route, won't you?
By December there may be what's called a final EIS, which would be the document that should not change and should be the basis of the ROD.
Okay.
And if that's the case, then we'll have much more detail.
Okay. All right. So with that, I'm going to poll the board. Quinn, would you poll the board, please?
Ms. Sandy.
Yes.
Ms. Wittgenstein-Rossi.
Yes.
Mr. Kennedy.
Yes.
Mr. Vogel.
Yes.
Mr. Anderson.
Yes.
Mr. Carl.
Yes.
Mr. Pruitt.
That was a lot of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Mr. Pruitt.
I'm with Bernie. Yes.
Motion carries.
Thank you.
I want to give it to Matt.
If I could just comment on the other project investment. So I'm working with PDAM, Allen's division. The issues of what are those roads in the Matsu would be public, but they may not need to meet public standards. And I've worked on this before. And also they may need less permitting than you see on this Ambler project.
With Tom. I like the logging roads.
No, well,
or building logging roads.
That's exactly.
It's their land. They shouldn't have to get any permits. They shouldn't have to do anything. Build the damn roads.
And then we're going to help them up. We're going to help them upgrade it.
I just wanted to back up Tom's comment that therefore it may be the proponent here on
the road. Just give Bernie a D1. Just let him go.
I just want to agree with you. If the borough is the proponent,
he's going to come up with a budget for you, John.
We put 10 miles of road. If you want to go see a beautiful 10 miles of road, you go to Skinny Dick's halfway in, and you go right, and we put 10.4 miles of all-weather road in,
We did that for $370,000 for 10 miles of road. We had to clear all the trees, put all the culverts in. We were logging. We did it out of our ass pocket, and we did it right from the seat of the dozer. Excuse me. We did it out of our rear pocket. So all I'm telling you is if it costs you more than, you ought to be able to put in 10 miles of road. I mean good road. You go look at it. It's beautiful. And that was for $371,000.
Go to Skinny Dick's?
Go to Skinny Dick's halfway, and you can get off there. And when I was logging, you could drive all the way into Nenana. So you didn't have to be on, you could be on.
So Bernie, there's this little thing, I'll just kind of remind you that when government does something, it's called Davis-Bacon prevailed wages. That you actually got to pay.
Chairman, I was just going to remind board member Carl about the permitting process is a little expensive if one were going to permit something.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to move on to, let's see here. Now, we're not doing resolution 17, 19 until the end. So are we doing a presentation, Tom?
Yes, I hope we're still ready.
And Julie said that there are some other people on the line that want to be recognized. Is that?
Let me get
you hear that.
I didn't hear anything.
Sorry.
Earlier when we took a break, there were several people online that were trying to get on the record that they had been online on their NFF earlier, but they were going to comment back to the Sherry.
Okay. All right, so this is the Callan report.
Yeah, we've got Brenda Applegate here, our Chief Financial Officer. We receive an annual report from Callan, investment consultant. Investment consultant for the ARM Board and Department of Revenue and the Permanent Fund and undoubtedly a number of municipalities. And so we have Callan online, I hope. And we have two.
Well, we can always postpone it till next until December.
We have two investment managers. One of them has been consistently above the bogey, and one has been both above and below the bogey. We're entirely in fixed income.
What does bogey mean?
What's your
definition of bogey?
That's their target.
Okay.
And the graphs in here show that.
So do we throw the ones under the bogey to the wolves, or what do we do?
Well, that's an option. In this case, we haven't had the kind of deviation from hitting the target that would warrant that discussion, certainly in any experience I have. I'll let Brenda go ahead. I've got to go sign something, if I could, and I'll be right back.
All right.
Could the Callan people identify themselves?
Yes. Yes, I'm going to introduce Gordon Waitman is on the line. He was going to be here present in person and wasn't able to travel, so he's calling in to do the presentation. And Gordon, you are online, correct?
I sure am.
Okay, great. So I'm going to drive the presentation, and Gordon is with Callan. They've been our investment advisors, and Callan monitors our portfolio performance and provides the quarterly reports that you get as part of your board packets. And annually, they have been coming up here and doing a presentation for the board to go over our fiscal year-end results of our portfolio, and that's what we're doing today. So, Gordon, I'll let you take over the presentation, and I will work the PowerPoint here.
Okay, thanks so much, Brenda, for that introduction. I'm Gordy Waitman, senior consultant here at Callan. I've been with the firm since 2006, and wanted to thank the board for over a 20-year relationship. Callan has a lot of clients in Alaska, so we do some work supporting the residents and also the public employees there. By working with the Alaska Permanent Fund and also the Alaska Retirement Management Board. Today we have a fairly brief agenda, and the way that it's structured, if you look at page one, is there's a market update, and then I was going to spend a few moments talking about the fixed income environment and then really get into your assets and holdings. My colleague Alex Ford is also on the line, and he was going to spend a little time talking about your actual managers and talk to you about that bogey that you mentioned, which we'll refer to as a benchmark here. It's really used as a risk and return index. And ultimately, we want the managers to beat it after fees over time. So there's a lot of information here. The intention is not to just flip pages. Before I begin, is there anything from the board that you would like to hear or questions addressed as it relates to the investment portfolio?
I'd like to know the fees we're paying for the managers as part of your presentation, please. Greg Samurajski.
I can state that up front if that's appropriate. You have two investment managers who are running core investment-grade bond portfolios for you. One of them is Alaska Permanent Capital Management. It's there in Alaska. They charge you 13 basis points on your assets. And the other manager is Barrow Hanley. They're based in Dallas, Texas, and they are at 23 basis points.
Okay, and
I would say that both of those are competitive.
Okay, and the numbers you report on pages 19 and 20, are those net or gross of those management fees?
These are gross for the sole reason that we're showing them against peers, and we don't have all the fees for the peers given your mandate size. And so instead of guessing, we put it at a gross level for an apples-to-apples comparison.
Thank you.
Go ahead, continue.
Okay, well, I'll start maybe with... I'll start on page 3 and just some highlights about the economy. Overall metrics are good. Gross domestic product, we still don't have a third quarter number, but the second quarter number is 2%. Consumer spending has been very healthy, which is two-thirds of that measurement. One of the head-scratchers with the easy monetary policy has been the lack of inflation. You see inflation at 1.7% over the last 12 months. That's well below the long-term average, and it implies that producers have been an employer have had a hard time really raising costs of their goods in this environment. Unemployment is another very healthy number, aggregated throughout the entire U.S. It's 3.5%, which is historically very low. Now, one of the things that's been going on is, for a while, we were in a very low interest rate environment where the Federal Reserve was keeping interest rates at 0%. And a few years ago, they started raising those short-term rates, only to reverse course at the beginning of 2019. And so far, we've seen two rate cuts this year, and there's a third, at least priced in by the market, to come in October. And so we continue to be in a very low interest rate environment, so much so now that you may have read or seen that there is a lot of negative yielding debt around the world. So just some quick figures. There is about $66 trillion in global government debt around the world. Right now, 26% of it has a negative interest rate, which essentially means that you are paying to have your money held, right? You're going to, at the end, if you hold a bond to maturity and it's $100 and you have a negative interest rate, well, that means you're going to get less back at the end than you initially put in. If you factor in inflation on that basis, over half of the world's government debt has a negative yield right now. And this is unprecedented. The smartest minds in the industry and in the investment industry don't really know how this is going to unfold. I mean, the intention of it is to stimulate growth. The simple concept is if you take rates to zero or negative, people aren't going to invest in fixed income. They're going to do something riskier. And we've certainly seen that with public equities, with private markets. There's just been a flood of capital chasing those returns. Some of the risks that we see now with, these negative rates are, all this movement into risky assets is scary because they still have a lot of risk, you're just being enticed to move there, incentivized to move there because of zero interest rate policy. It has bearings on bank profitability, puts pressure on retirees who are getting close to retirement and are looking to preserve capital. All of a sudden, they have negative rates. Just a little quick tidbit. There are mortgages in Europe right now, 30-year mortgages that have negative rates, which means if you pay nothing towards your debt, the debt actually decreases on your home loan.
Kind of.
I'm in the wrong damn business.
They're actually paying people.
Yeah. Okay, so we need to speed this up. So.
Yes.
Did you hear that, Gordon?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Let me do that. If you'll go quickly then to page.
We have two board members leaving here between 2 and 3 o'clock. And so
okay.
I'm going to switch around to what we're going to talk about after this. I think I want to go right to Navis system, whatever, and do executive session after that because of the timing.
So I think we'll have to speed it up a little, Gordon.
Let's go right to page 12.
I like these kind of presentations.
So as of June 30th, 2019, you see there's $502.5 million in the total pool. Some of that is internally managed in U.S. Treasuries, about $99 million, and then there's $403.5 million with your external managers. So that gives you a sense of the scale of the assets. Page 13 shows performance, and again, this is on a growth of fee basis. And the first thing you'll notice over the last year is at the total fund level, you got 6.6%, very strong. We don't expect that that's going to happen going forward from your current investment policy, mainly because we've seen a decline in interest rates, and there's an inverse relationship between the price of a bond and it's in the interest rate. So when rates go down, bond prices go up.
Is this Bloomberg, the same Bloomberg that used to be mayor of the New York?
It's a company he founded.
It's his firm.
It's his firm?
It's his firm.
Well, we get rid of that already.
Get
him out of there. Yeah, we want a different person.
Well, that index, mostly in the U.S. at least, is the most used bond index.
Spend money with you people. You
and it used to be the Barclays aggregate, and before that it was the Lehman aggregate. So it doesn't have a great history of who.
That's a good comment.
But the construction has always been in representative of the market value of bonds within the U.S. landscape. So a great fiscal year from a return perspective. Going forward, the yield on your bond portfolios is about 2.5%. And so absent any substantial moves in interest rates, that's what we would expect really over the next 5 years.
Just a couple
minutes. So for the board's, just a minute. So for the board's knowledge, at a work session in December, we're going to talk about this and our investment strategies. And Tom has some maybe a different take on what we'll talk about in December, about doing something a little bit different. And we'll look forward to that. I thought it was a pretty good idea. You brought it up to me yesterday, and I thought it made some sense. But that's going to happen in December. So this is just your looking back what we got. So we're familiar with where we're at, so we can talk about it at our work session and a path forward in December.
Okay. Page 14, I think, is a powerful slide. What it shows is over the last nearly 20 years, what your returns have been like each fiscal year. And so each point on this line here is a rolling one-year return. And you can see the average of your investment portfolio is 4.4%. With core investment-grade bonds. That's about what we would have expected 20 years ago. But you can see there's some variability along the way. You have one-year returns that are more than 10%, and there are actually a couple that are negative. And so there have been a few times where you've been negative. Fiscal year 2018 was slightly negative. And so this helps capture the risk and the amount of return you get for that risk, recognizing that you could have some periods where you have negative returns and unrealized losses. That's shown a little differently on slide 15, just with the bar charts, and basically tracks how your fixed income managers have done versus that benchmark with a history of success over it. Finally, just to talk briefly about your managers, and we'll try to do this in 3 minutes, I'll turn it over to Alex Ford to cover pages 19 and 20.
Great. Thank you, Gordy. And good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and board members. Just quick introduction. My name's Alex Ford. I recently joined the team here at Cowen last month, but at my prior firm, I've been doing the same work for more than 11 years. So happy to be with you all today, and we'll wrap up with just a quick dive into your two external managers, page 19. This is the Alaska Permanent Capital Management run strategy, the more conservative of the two active external portfolios. You can see that reflected in their results at the bottom of the page here. From an absolute basis, the last year has been very strong, up almost 7.4%. But relative to the benchmark, that Bloomberg aggregate, and also relative to a group of peers shown in the bar chart at the top, it has been somewhat lagging. You know, from our viewpoint, this is to be expected. They have kind of less exposure to credit. And they, for what kind of credit they hold in their portfolio, they have a much higher quality bias. And therefore, they're obtaining a lower yield out of the market. That's by design. The point of that is to really give you that downside protection and really ensure that we're preserving capital through any kind of market stressed environments. If you look out over longer periods, over 10 and 15 years, encouragingly, you can see the strategy adding value and beating the bogey, beating the benchmark there by you know an amount that would encompass their level of fee. Page 20. This is the second manager, Beryl Hanley, as Gordy mentioned, based out of Dallas. They are going to have a similar risk profile as Alaska Capital. They're kind of looking for undervalued bonds within the marketplace to purchase, and again, with that risk, with that eye towards kind of downside protection in market sell-offs. Our numbers here are through 6/30. We did get a more recent update through the end of the third quarter, 9/30. And I can just tell you that for that quarter, so far this year, a 1 year, and since inception, so over all of those periods, this strategy is beating out its market benchmark, the Bloomberg aggregate. The trailing year by 15 basis points, and since inception by about 11 basis points. So, you know, on a net fee basis, it's very close to the benchmark, the opportunity set that you're targeting, and it's doing it with a lower risk profile. So that's how your two external managers are performing. We think all in all, they're doing what they have been hired to do, and really kind of keeping an eye on preserving capital within the entire program. Now I'll pause there. That kind of concludes our formal remarks, and just see if there are any questions.
Questions from board members? Greg, you've kind of been in this business, so
can I make a comment?
Sure.
So, and this could be easily a discussion for December, but back of the envelope, I calculated we're paying about $1 million worth of fees, and it seems like we're getting almost nothing for it. Over the last 6 years, for example, Beryl Hanley is underperforming once you subtract 23 basis points. Over the last 5 years, Alaska Permanent Capital is underperforming whether or not you subtract their 13. One of the services the Treasury Department provides is free, nothing's really free, but we provide fund management services for almost every fund in the state, including the PCE. And you know, I think we probably beat our benchmarks by a couple basis points, but I believe that's something we would offer to ADA. At a minimum, it'd be $1 million savings right off the top. So now, I don't expect anybody to make a decision on that, and certainly I'm representing the department I work in. But that's something we could definitely talk about in advance of the December meeting if we want to keep the same level of management. It's something we basically do, you know, as a service to all the state funds.
And you're already doing that as a course of business.
You know, like we do the PC, which is $1 billion, constitutional budget reserve, and we probably manage, I don't know, and then the ARM board itself, we do $10 billion there, so.
Holy smokes.
And we custom design it for the needs of the funds. I'm just saying it's a good way to cut $1 million off.
Blame me.
That's what we're doing.
That is very
Brenda?
I was just going to add that our contracts with our external managers, I believe, are up in April of 2020.
That's a good time to be looking at it.
Well, this is something, again, for December, our December work session.
Yeah, we want to make sure we get that on the list, though, because that's very important.
Could I make a request?
Yeah.
Could we have some type of analysis? Because how much additional headcount are we going to have to pay for, et cetera, et cetera? There's always added costs, right? And so if we could have an analysis on what truly that
And I could have Brenda work with our CIO to actually work out what it is we'd want and how Ada manages its money and how we could do that.
But I know from a department perspective, we get hit with a lot of assigned costs that we have absolutely no control over. So I wouldn't want this to be misleading. It's like you're going to save $1 million and oops, you got half, you know, $500,000 here in the cost. So if we could just really
we definitely wouldn't add headcount for this because we do have about 30 of these.
I'm just saying, let's do the full analysis.
Yeah, no, it's got to be full.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be all in. Apples to apples.
But you can do that. You can give us an all-in number, right? What it's going to cost us?
Yeah.
Okay.
Excellent.
Further comments from the board?
Okay.
That's perfect.
Good. Thank you very much, folks, online.
Yes,
appreciate
so
your
much.
Time. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, but I think
I love this. Oh, wow.
I'm trying to get through it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Okay. So, Tom, we originally talked about moving resolution G1719 to the end, but I'm going to bring that back. I want to bring that back up now before executive session because Commissioner Anderson has to leave to meet with the governor here in 45 minutes. So, I want to get that out of the way. And bring it up now for board's approval. Is that okay?
Yes.
All right. So, Tom, we're going to talk about resolution G17-19, approving a Navisystem system upgrade with server upgrade.
And we brought the A-team here just for this. And
yeah, I always worry when Curtis shows up.
What's that?
Were you leaving then?
No, I'm just here to learn.
What did I do with that? Okay, here. All right, I'll let you guys talk about where we were, where we are at, and where we're going, and why we're here.
You want me to start off? Okay. Just in a summary, Resolution G1917A is an amendment to Resolution G1917, which was approved by the board previously.
When was that?
That was in December of 2017.
Okay.
Relating to the authorization for an upgrade to ADA and AEA's Enterprise Financial Software and Servers, the Vision. The history of the project is included in the memo in your board packets. So I was just going to go over the amendments. The amendments requested include a change in scope. There is an upgrade from version 7.0 to the latest version of MS-DIM 65 Business Central on-premises version 13.3. The original resolution took us from version 7.0 to version 10.0. Purchase of a new recommended servers to fully support, maintain, and improve the functionality for the life cycle of the new software. and the migration of the current SQL server to a new SQL server 2012 to reduce risk and vulnerability for ADA and AEA during the upgrade. And lastly, to implement the required MS license structure upgrade from concurrent users to named users. In addition to these changes in scope, we're also requesting an additional $240,000 in funding. That's in addition to the original $100,000 that was authorized to allow for the increase in estimates, additional on-site contractor support, and the purchase of a new server that wasn't in the original budget.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, Julie.
So is it explained about what was the delay from the original 2017 approval of that and why we didn't go at that time from the 7 to the 10 and now we're going to a 13?
I can address that. When we went to the board in December of 2017, the original schedule was we were going to begin in November of 2018 with an anticipated finish of the project in June of 2019. In between when we went to the board and when we were going to begin, there were a lot of things going that happened. Some of the things were we had some staffing issues. There was a change in technology. Version 13.3 came out during that time. Those were the major things. It was really workloads, staffing, and changes in technology.
Workload, staffing, that doesn't make sense to me.
We had multiple projects going on. The PC web portal was one of the projects we were working on. The staff that was working on that project was also the same staff that would need to work on the upgrade. We had some new staff coming on board or changing positions that hadn't been trained yet.
You didn't anticipate that with the original $100,000 request?
In December of 2017, we didn't anticipate some of those things happening, no.
So, Mr. Chair, you said that you got the approval in December of 2017, but you didn't have an anticipated start date of November of 18. What's the year lag of implementation?
It was an assessment of the audit schedules and everything. Honestly, we shouldn't have gone to the board as early as we did. Doing the implementation during our audit period isn't a good idea because it's to our financial system. And so we went to the board in December. It wouldn't have been a good idea for us to start then because it would have led into the audit period. So we decided we needed to really defer until the November date. So hindsight, I think we went to the board too soon.
Are we out of compliance via IT since we're so far back on a version that they don't have, that they don't operate anymore?
We are getting to the end of the life for our software and our servers, but it'll be in January, I think, of
2020. But are we out of compliance now?
I don't believe so.
We will not be out of compliance currently, but during the migration to the new up thing, we will be out of compliance.
And if we had have done this upgrade back in 17 or 18, would we have remained in compliance?
Yes.
So who's responsible for this not being implemented?
That was a decision that we discussed internally. It was approved by both executive directors at the time, so it was management.
Who's management?
It would be myself and the two executive directors that were here. Not these two, but the previous executive directors.
You're not a jail free card, Tom.
if we had done the $100,000 upgrade, would we still now be looking for 340 minus 100,000? Would we still be looking for 240 today, or did we lose money by not doing what we were supposed to do when we were supposed to do it?
A part of the increase in the cost was a change in project managers with the vendor who's going to help with the upgrade. And what they told us is that the proposal that was given to us originally was too low. And the new person that came on board said that that wasn't accurate. So I would think that we would have, because we pay them by the hour, we probably would have had to come back and get more money if what they're telling us is true. Additionally, one of the reasons why we delayed is now we're going to go from version 7 to version 13.3, so we're skipping a version. So instead of, we would have had to do an upgrade again. By the time we got started the first time, we would have had only 4 years left of our 5-year life cycle on our software, so we would have had to do an upgrade sooner. If we do the upgrade now, we'll have 5 years left, so we're skipping an upgrade.
How long has this upgrade been available, 13.3?
I believe it was announced late in 2018.
So
right about the time that we decided to defer.
So we'll have to do another upgrade probably fairly soon anyways.
And I think there's a 5-year life cycle for it. Is that? Yes.
So we have 3 years before an upgrade?
2024. I think what you're asking, and the answer is if this was done in 2018, we would not be having this conversation until 2023 because it's a 5-year. Because it was skipped, now there's a newer version out there. But if we had stayed to the original schedule, we would not be in this room today asking for this upgrade to go to version 13. We would be operating on 10, and then we would go to the latest version when that became available in 14, you know, in 2022-23.
Correct.
And there is an opportunity cost we missed. By missing this, this is costing an additional about $90,000. Because when we miss the deadline and we transition over the summer in July, it's about $50,000 more in security cost because we're operating two systems.
So we've already transitioned to the new system?
No.
So what's
the end of life?
What's the security risk on this, by the way?
Well, Terrence, our IT director, is here. And
how long will it take to do it, and how do we have any risk at all?
I mean, of course, there's always...
Please come up to the microphone.
Come on up, please.
Chair, borrow my mic.
I'm Terrence Cato, the IT director. Of course, there's risk, but we're going to take steps to mitigate the risk by installing a new server, interim server to cover us, and we're going to upgrade the operating system and the database system to hold us over. While we go through the upgrade process, with that, we go under the Microsoft license agreement, the same one that DCED shares with us. There would be a cost of operating two servers over the fiscal year, because the fiscal year goes from July 1st through June 30. And with that, you have to buy a new server, new SQL Server licenses, and the license model changes on the new servers. Whereas your legacy servers, you're grandfathered into the old server licensing system. So,
okay. So, Terrence, we're not going to be worried about any software or any problem with third parties coming in and getting confidential information from AIDA or AEA ever.
Be honest.
Hey. We're going to be operating old software, so there's a risk.
How long is the risk?
Until we go live with the new system.
And how long will that take?
We are looking at a couple different options right now. August 2020 is what we're currently looking at, but we are trying to dial that back.
How big is the window? How many days?
January to August.
It originally was 300 days, and we've cut it down 2 months, so 240 days.
Go ahead.
It seems to me we're exactly where we were in December of 2017.
Yeah, we're only a little worse, because we have more liability now.
Yeah. Right, but we're still coming into the audit season. Yeah. We're still asking for the money before we are really ready to implement. So it might be good to look at a better... more fully developed budget and timeline of what we're really asking to do, and then identify what those risks may be associated with that, just so we have more information to make a decision.
I agree. Would it be proper now to make a motion to table this resolution?
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second that, but I yes.
Okay. Discussion? Julie?
I think we need some more information. The timing, you know, when you talked about what led up to the problems and 2 years ago, we're asking to do the same thing at the same time. So inevitably, it seems like we're going to have the same result. So I would just ask that you come back in December and outline what exactly, when you plan to implement, what the risks are and what the costs are, and more fully detailed so we can have
an informed decision. Is there any objection to tabling the resolution?
Thank you.
Nope. Hearing no objections, tabled. Thank you.
There's a security risk that you've now entered into.
Thank you.
All right, that brings
us up to executive session.
Right. We move into executive session. Shug it.
Opposition. Where do we want to have it? Here or someplace else?
I think we can have it.
Oh, okay.
Confidential information related to the Mustang development.
Yeah.
I motion that we move into executive session to discuss the Mustang development project.
Second.
Okay. Where are we doing it at?
I think we can do it here.
Okay.
And we'll need.
Julie will have to call back in anyway.
Yeah. I'll have to disconnect the call line and log into the executive session line.
Yep. I'll disconnect now and then log back in.
All right. I'll be in there in a few minutes. Thank you.
Send me a text or note or something.
Right, yeah. You're back on the record.
Thank you. I'd advise that the board has not taken any formal actions on the matters discussed while we're in executive session. That brings us to item number 8, director's comments. Tom, do you have some short comments?
No, I really don't. I think everything that I needed to say has been said in the course of today. I'd be glad to answer any questions. I do try to keep the board informed with, irregular but frequent email updates, and I could certainly modify those in any way anyone might like, and especially if there are areas that I haven't been including that I should be including or anything, be happy. I could make them more frequent or, so anyway, I don't really have any comments to make that I haven't made in the course of today.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. I'll note that on item number D, the regular session's board meeting is for Wednesday, December 4th, and we have a work session the following day, December 5th. So just FYI, that's and we'll talk about the Callan report, return on investments, the whole slew of things, maybe a little, I also, the board would like to, FYI, Tom, you can Sherry know, I'll just let her know that we're going to have another work session before the board meeting on the 4th, and okay. We'll talk about the topic a little bit later.
Yep.
Okay. All right, board comments?
Well, I just, I really do appreciate, Tom, very much. I love your updates, so thank you for doing that, and I hope you keep it up. I find it very informative, and I truly like getting that. There's no simple solutions, only intelligent choices, and I really like the effort that you put in. So thank you.
Thanks.
Greg?
What he says.
Okay. I just want to say thank you to, again, the ADA staff for all that you do here, and thanks for bringing that up. One request that I do have, Tom, is that I'd like to see on our agendas is basically an update from each of your department heads to let us know what is going on coming forth, because it feels to me like, I didn't know like the $700,000 was coming up. I didn't know about the $100,000 or the other request that was coming. It'd be nice to know what's coming down the pike that we can be prepared for instead of just the packet dropping a week before the board meetings. And I like that for AEA as well. Thank you.
John?
All right. Well, again, I want to thank everybody, and long day for Ada. Hopefully AEA shorter. We will...
Dana?
Go ahead, Julie.
Sorry, my only comment is just with regard to our earlier conversation on shared services and staffing, is it possible to request that the executive director of Ada and AEA perhaps provide some feedback about where they or staff are currently following state process when the statute or the regulation does not specifically require it? I think I've shared this before, but, you know, having worked for the state for more than 20 years and also my own private businesses for just as long, I guess, I'm aware, and I think everyone else is, that following state processes often neither speaks common sense, efficiency, or cost reductions. I know that isn't a reflection of the people who are working in the jobs. I know there are a lot of hardworking Alaskans both at ADA and AEA. So I just want to, since we're not using UGF to fund the positions, I guess I just would like to know where we can possibly advocate for seeing ADA follow functions that look more like the private sector when possible, especially if it's the intent that ADA would make money.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a fair ask.
Yep. Yes, I think
okay.
That's great.
Brenda? Okay. Look forward to that. I think that'd be very educational to all of us. All right. With that, again, thank you, Data staff. Corinne, thank you for putting this together. And our favorite attorney, Jerry, over there, you know. With that, do we have a motion for adjournment?
Second.
Objection or adjournment? All right, quick break, and then we'll start with...